so we can all talk about it and talk about beer and just relax and talk about life like we're supposed to and not worry about what's on the TV. So yeah, no, it's everybody doesn't, yeah, it just kind of seems like everybody doesn't really know how to play it. So I don't know.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense, Brian. Thanks for putting this together too. I work part-time at the local like liquor supermarket, and it's been nuts there. So many people and so much business. In fact, they're paying employees time and a half to keep working because there are people who don't want to work. Right. But it's been great. The interactions with customers are a little further away, but otherwise it's like, oh yeah, here's this, or you know, I basically Ondex needs to pay me a little bit extra money because basically that's all I do is sell Ondex by the case, more or less. So I love that beer.
So you are on Instagram.
Yeah.
German. Okay.
Yeah, it's me. Yeah, it's me.
Hey, how's it going?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good, man.
It's cool to, you know, put this all together. The minute you said that, I was like, light bulb. I know someone who does that.
Yeah. I'm just a fan.
Yeah. Hell yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah. So yeah, my buddy and I, we're going to have I have to cut out a little bit. We have a virtual Stammtisch tonight.
Nice.
We have, and we're going to do that. We're going to do the, I actually brought him over. I dropped off his porch, the, Roadhouse pills.
Nice.
As a surprise for him. So
that's awesome. That's awesome. No, there needs to be that. I don't know. It's just so weird. It's just, whatever, here we are.
Yeah.
So, what was I gonna say? I don't remember now. So on Instagram, are you German Beer Culture? Is that what it is? Yeah, okay.
Yep.
Okay. All right, cool. Yeah, that's awesome. No, I was hoping some people would join and so we could just talk about beer.
Yeah.
Seems like everybody who joined so far is namely German beer fans. I know some of the guys like some other stuff, but I know a lot of the people that I see on this list are definitely German beer fans. I know Andrew goes over there, has been there quite a bit. And Bilsch or Russ or whatever he wants to be called tonight, he has an interesting backstory that maybe he should share if he wants to about Germany and how he got there.
You talking to me?
I'm talking to you.
I missed it. I'm sorry. I was typing something else. One more time.
Oh, we were all talking about our love for Germany and German beers. And I said, you probably have the most interesting story on how you ended up over there.
Oh, well, I ended up having to go over there three times a year for business. Used to own a company that manufactured theatrical special effects. And so we had a warehouse in Berlin that we sold out of. So I always had to go over there. And of course, got to do a lot of drinking. And when you're over there, and hit Munich a lot of times. So I've pretty much been at most of the decent beer brewing towns in Germany several times. So it's good to tune the palate so you know what to do, you know, brewing here. So many people don't really even know what to shoot for, you know, as far as flavors go in their beers, if you haven't drank them fresh from the source. So, yeah, that's my story.
Can you give away one of your large customers? Can you tell people who that was?
Oh, well, probably the largest customer is Disney. Maybe SeaWorld runs second, and then Six Flags Parks. There's a company in Berlin that buys an awful lot of stuff that does touring, so I think Rammstein's probably the biggest consumer of a theatrical pyro of any band. Kiss is out right now, so I just sold the factory a little while ago, and I still go out there every now and then just to check in with them, and they're doing Kiss and shit, so many other bands, I can't even keep up with it anymore. But I hear that most of the concerts are canceled now, and so they're kind of going into stock up mode these days. So
And Disneyland shut down and all the theme parks, and
They're a bit nervous, but the company in Berlin is actually stockpiles a lot of products. So from what I heard is they're told that they can keep working for 3 weeks to a month and just manufacture product for Europe. So So they should be pretty good. I'm just happy I sold out before all this shit happened. Doesn't sound like a good time to be in business doing anything.
No, and that's another interesting mental challenge is what's going to happen if when it comes back, you know, with all the small business, all the business in general. That's going to be are we going to go into kind of a recession mode, or are we going to that's going to be interesting too. So
it's going to be a lot of stale beer in the store shelves when things open back up. I mean, if you know, places where they've closed, like here.
There's going to be a lot of all sorts of things to work through.
No, it's interesting. Oh, go ahead, Andrew.
I was just going to say, I have a friend that just opened a brewery, and he is a low oxygen brewer too, and he makes fantastic German lagers, and he's still able to sell carry out. But I do worry about them, because although they were very successful in the few months they've been open, I can't imagine trying to weather this kind of a situation being that young.
Yeah, that's tough. In the Indy area or where, Andrew?
Yeah, it's in a suburb of Indianapolis. It's called Primeval Brewing.
Okay.
And I think this guy reads the forum. He's a member of the forums and reads them, but I don't think he posts a lot. Sure. But
cool. Was he in your club too, or what?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There are several of us in our club that are really into German styles, and we're a very technical club.
Sure.
And a number of us have adopted the way.
The way. Yeah, well, that's cool. I'm always happy to see that, you know, professional brewers are doing good. That's tough. I know I do quite a bit of consulting for breweries around here too, and it's all kind of up in the air. You know, you can do takeouts. One of the breweries actually put up a website, and they can, so I guess you can like order 6-packs and 12-packs from the website and just go in and pick it up. I don't know if that's a new rule nationally or just in Minnesota or whatever. I think it's kind of, when it comes to that kind of stuff, it's kind of like the Wild Wild West right now as far as rules and agency and all that stuff. I don't think anyone really knows what's going on, and just kind of turns a blind eye. I guess there's other things there's bigger fish to fry, I guess, but.
Yeah, in Illinois, just recently before all this, they actually just passed the growler law. They let bars fill growlers, and people are kind of like, whatever. And now it's like, well, we got to promote this just to stay afloat and stay open. We have a craft beer bar by us that's selling like rare kegs, stuff like, you know, entire kegs of like Bourbon County Montchery. Like, you can buy that. That six stole.
Well,
I mean, it's $500, but yeah, you can buy it.
Yeah, that's crazy. But I guess, I mean, you got to do what you got to do. I don't know.
How many people have a Sankey tap for that?
I don't know. That's
I guess the last one, probably, right?
yeah, exactly. So, but you know, hey, they got to try to stay open how they can. They're good to the community.
Yeah,
you know, people are just trying to support them and, you know, go from there.
I got a question for the hive mind here. Has anyone ever figured out how to get CO2 into a mini keg that you open so you don't lose the rest of the beer?
Mini keg, how, like the little, like 1 liters or what?
No, the, like I got like Hofbräu mini keg. I was going to share it with my neighbors, but now everybody's on lockdown. I got this keg sitting in my fridge and I'm dying to do it, but trying to figure out if there's a way I can, like, you know, get CO2 into it instead of venting it to air, because I mean, by the next day it'll be shit.
I think someone makes a kit for those. So really? that little plastic, it's a like a red plastic top that you, it's yeah. like white and
give
red.
A quarter
and,
turn.
Yeah. Yep. I think someone makes a little like, I don't know who it is, but you pop that thing out and there's a bung that you put in and it uses the little CO2 cartridges, whatever they are, 11 gram or whatever. Mm-hmm. And you can push it with that. I think you might have to do a little Google searching on that, but I thought there was someone who was doing that.
I am as we speak.
That makes sense because it is just a rubber bung.
Yep.
Flange. Once you pop out that valve, it seems like you could, any as long as you can find the right diameter thing to stick in there. Of course, you'd have to plug it then and keep it airtight.
Oh, thanks. There you go. Hey guys, I gotta check out. I'm gonna say goodnight to my son, but Brian, do this again sometime, man. I'm in. So
okay, great. Take nice care. To finally meet you. Take
nice to meet you too, guys. Take care, guys.
See you later.
I thought someone was doing that. If not, you might get crazy and do like a like a needle that you would blow up a ball with, like a basketball, and stick that in the rubber bung.
Goes through the rubber.
Yep.
Huh.
JCF just posted a high dollar solution, I assume, in the chat.
Oh,
there we go. Attaboy, JCF.
Wow. $50, pretty nice.
Yeah, but I think those are different kind of kegs, though. Those ones already have the like the widget inside of them, don't they? The Heineken ones?
You might be right on that.
I think they already have the CO2 thing in them, whereas these other kegs are just like you vent the top and you lose them.
Yeah, then it's a gravity pour.
That is a beer format that I have, I think, never purchased.
That's 250.
Nothing against it. I just haven't ever had occasion to.
I have only tried it once. I think it was with a Heineken keg, but it was you know what? Seasonally, I do get the Hofbräu Oktoberfest, and I'll get it in that 1 liter or whatever size it actually is.
But it's gravity. 5 liters.
It's 5 liters?
Yeah.
Yeah, and then I'll do it in the gravity pour and all that fun stuff. But I try and go through it in 2 days. So I'll get it on like a Friday and I'll try and drink it by
You can make it last like so it'll go 24 hours without going to shit?
Oh yeah. 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 I find like on Sunday, if I tapped it on Friday, I find that like on Sunday it'll start getting flat and sweet.
Huh. Okay, cool. Well, that's good to know. I guess the real question I wanted to know is, will I go to hell if I waste a couple of liters of Hofbräu beer?
No,
it's Ondex beer. If you waste Ondex beer.
Yeah, there's some religion.
Good to know.
There's a bar that I can walk to in Santa Monica that has Weihenstephan Hef and Weihenstephan Original on draft, but they keep all their kegs warm. So half the time I go in there and it's like an oxidized stale keg. The other time it's like perfect. So lo and behold, I have to brew my own.
What's the name of that place? I was at a place like that. You walk in the door and all the kegs are just sitting there on the ground.
Daily Pint.
What?
Daily Pint.
Oh, okay. Oh, this place was more up by the Bay Area, I think. But same thing, you walk in the front and they have a little German store there. You know, and there's like 15, 20 kegs just sitting there all warm. It's like, wow, sad.
What? Tragedy. What are they just pouring through a cold plate or what?
They have like a couple, you know, kegerator systems, but they've got maybe 30 or 40 kegs kind of in reserve, just standing around under the billiards tables and stuff.
Wow.
They have a great selection. It's like they got Pliny the Elder, they've got Bourbon County verticals. It's like anything you could want is there. It's just half the time it's been sitting warm for a month.
Sure. Yeah, that's tough. That's tough. Poor beer. There are hundreds of these things. JC, I don't think it's a dispenser. I think it's, I'm gonna have to search for it. But the problem is, oh man, and I can't multitask. So the minute I start searching for it, you'll lose me on chat because I'll be focused.
Oh, looks like the second one you said might be for the kind of keg that I have. Oh, cool.
I'm gonna go grab a beer. I'll be back in a few.
Excellent. Hey, Steve, how are you doing? So you don't have a mic, but you, oh, hey, yeah, I see you in chat there. Where are you joining in from tonight? You can get those 5 liters at Total Wine for $20. That's crazy. Warsteiner, 5 liter, $20 at Total Wine. That's crazy. Oh, here it is. All right. It's an eBay link, but I'll put it in the chat. Honolulu. Excellent. Can't say I've been to Hawaii.
Ah, perfect.
There you go. Yeah.
That's what I was thinking. I know I've seen that before.
Yeah, that looks like the right thing right there.
And excellent. I think that's the actual tap with the CO2. So
yeah, it looks like it's got a standpipe that comes with it and everything.
Yeah, Party Star. Party Star.
Perfect.
That's better than the Party Pig.
It's even in German too, if you look at the pictures. Wow. Fast frisch. Fresh keg. Cool. It's pretty great. Been here 2 years. Even one from Bangor, Washington.
What's the lockdown situation in Hawaii? I don't think I'd mind being locked down in Hawaii, I guess.
Yeah. It'd be beautiful.
Although it is hard to get brewing ingredients there, right? As I recall.
Inexpensive, right?
Yeah, you pretty much have to import everything unless things have changed. Oh, wow. So you are on lockdown then. Crazy expensive, yeah.
Oh, so you're in the Navy. So you're at Pearl Harbor-ish area, potentially. Yeah, Pearl Harbor. Cool. $3 special use, $2 base. I mean, that's not crazy expensive, but it's expensive. Is there any homebrew stores on the island there? I would assume there is. Nice. JCF, where are you from? Where are you out of? St. Louis. Cool. There's a few of us Midwest folk here. What beer did you grab, Josh?
Homebrewed blonde ale. It's my like third low oxygen beer that I've brewed.
Nice. What do you think of it?
It turned out really well. I mostly just brewed it so I could have like a big yeast starter for a stout. But it's drinking better than most beers I've, you know, able to get. Just 100% Great Western two row with a few ounces of Nelson Sauvin for kind of aroma and flavor addition.
Nice.
I like that Great Western two row. I use that for my American beers most of the time.
It was interesting getting the low oxygen process. It kind of sometimes gave me a little bit of like a green pea, like a snap pea kind of flavor to it. You just get totally different kind of aroma off that.
Who was it? There was someone else who talked about that picking up that same kind of thing too, and I'm trying to remember who that was. I haven't used much of Great Western. I used to use who's that malt North Country, right? North Country is basically who stocks the Great Western.
Yeah.
The Great Western's out of Canada, right? That's where their malt house is.
I think yeah. So.
There's like Country Malt Group or Canada Maltings or something.
Okay. And I used to use Country Malt Group, and then I switched to BSG, and BSG pimps their RAR because BSG is RAR. And so I just started using RAR. So I haven't used any Great Western for, I don't know, probably 7 to 8 years. But when I did use it, it was solid.
I mean, it tastes really good. It's just, and I've heard a couple people say certain times, like the malt might get that character a bit. You know, maybe one out of every four beers that I pour, I pick it up when it's warm or something.
Interesting.
I wonder if that's just if like you're getting a fresh grain. Like a lot of times I get a grain kernel kind of character that borders on like slightly vegetal, but not in a DMS like vegetal note, but like a fresh, like a very fresh, almost green grain note.
Yeah, it probably is more on that end. Like the first blonde that I brewed, I milled it a little too quickly, and so I got a lot more kernel kind of, or a lot of the husks kind of got shredded, and I could kind of taste that, like it changed the texture a bit versus this one. I went really slow and I don't get as much huskiness from it.
Isn't that crazy? People think I'm crazy when I say I can taste like husky flavors, and that you could pick that up, that nuance of husk flavor in and about the beer. I find that super crazy to be able to pick up those nuanced flavors.
Yeah, sometimes it's weird talking to people that can't even tell their beer is infected, you know, when they're homebrewing. Like, what is your palate telling you right now?
Yeah, that's, you know, whatever. I guess more power to them because all the beer is good, and then you don't have to worry about it. It's all good. See, for me, it's the exact opposite. Nothing's ever good. It's all bad. So you don't want that problem.
It's the curse of being a super taster. I mean, I think you, like me, I just have to, I'm fairly good at turning it off and just sort of ignoring it so that I can have fun if I need to.
Sure.
But, you know, it's tough to, you know, when you're out trying to order beer, it's like, it reminds me of that meme with the guy, like with the two button choices and he's sweating. Like that's what it's like. Cause like, I'm going to hate whatever I get unless I know for sure. And I know the establishment has been taking right. care of the product.
Right. No, that's a big deal too.
Hey, can you guys hear me all right?
Yep.
Absolutely. Good evening. How are you doing?
Doing good. Doing good. I figured out I just go to my cell phone instead of trying to make it work on my desktop.
Yeah, it looks great. Video and audio sound great. So I tried to do the Zoom because it seemed to be the most friendly with devices and all that, you know, Mac, PC, phone, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So where are you joining from tonight?
Yeah, Honolulu. I was Steve from the I canceled out and tried to try on my phone.
There we go. That makes sense. All the way from Honolulu.
Yeah, man. It's tough. The weather's terrible.
I bet. Says I in Minnesota, and I can still see snow on the ground. Yeah, I bet the weather's terrible there.
Yeah, I'm moving to the Seattle area at the beginning of next year, so that'll be a little bit of change of pace. But
yep. Yeah, you'll have a little bit more seasons
there. Probably a little bit more beer scene too.
Yeah, that's definitely a good beer scene over there. Is there any good kind of local small microbrews there besides Kona, which sold out to AB and all that fun stuff?
Yeah, there's probably a dozen breweries on the island. There's like Honolulu Beer Works, there's Ola, there's Maui Brewing Company, which is actually around Maui.
Okay.
There's a couple other. The Beer Lab, which kind of they just do IPAs and stuff like that. But yeah, there's pretty good beer here.
Good, and even if there's mediocre beer, there's fantastic scenery, so that makes...
Right, that's true. It's hard to be anything but like... So like my first couple months on the island, all I was doing was smiling as I was driving around. I was like, oh, this is beautiful all over the place. And I was coming from Connecticut, which at the time was dead and desolate because of just winter.
Sure.
Everything dies. So it's always green, it's always sunny, it's great.
Nice.
Have you had the deconstructed Mai Tai at the Modern Honolulu?
No, I have not. Would you recommend it? Is it just shots of different alcohols?
It's just like an insane Mai Tai. It's probably one of the best cocktails I've ever had. One of my friends recommended it to me when I was staying in Honolulu for work, and every time I go, I have to go get a couple.
Yeah, where is that?
The Modern Honolulu Hotel.
All right. I'll have to try that out after all this stuff stops.
Have you gotten into poke?
Oh yeah, man. That's my favorite thing. Super good. My wife can't stand it, but somehow brought fish and all of it.
Right. I've never had it, but my in-laws have some really close friends that have a house out there. I believe they're in Maui, but they rave about it. I've never had.
Yeah, man, it's just some tuna with some onions and some other things, depending on what kind you're getting. It's just simple and delicious. And you know what you're eating is good because there's basically nothing done to it.
Sure. Do a lot of like the smaller people actually go out and, you know, spearfish the fish or catch the fish for that day?
Yeah, there's a lot of local fishing here, just like commercial fishing, like everywhere else. But also, yeah, I mean, see people going out spearfishing all the time. They have like the 4 foot long fins and stuff. And yep. They're mostly locals. But,
That'd be cool. Yeah, that'd be fun. How long you been out there? Did you say a year?
Yeah, about 2 years. Got here just before Christmas of 2017.
Okay.
Awesome. We're going to another submarine here at the end of the year.
Oh, so you're a submarine guy.
Yeah, man. Six, 16 years so far.
I know. I have a really good friend out in Pennsylvania that's a submarine guy.
Was he in Pittsburgh?
Yep.
At Bettis Atomic Power Laboratories or something?
Yeah, somewhere over there. He's now retired, but he's younger. But sure. He's out of it. He was in the nuclear powered subs. And then went from that to nuclear reactor refilling or recharge, whatever that would be. Sure. And made a very good living off of that for a couple of years. And now he doesn't do anything. So
that's the goal.
Yep.
That's the goal.
Yep. He's brilliant too. And actually, he was actually, a lot of my inspiration for my brew system came from him as well, because he was really the first one who did really heavy automation and did the mass flow sensors and all sorts of crazy automation gear. And that's where I get a lot of my automation gear from too. But he has since gave up brewing. So
yeah, I drool every time I look at your gear, man. It's ridiculous.
Oh, thank you.
I made up a little, like a Brutus 10 kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I thought I was fancy. And then I saw your LCD touchscreen, all low oxygen stuff. I'm like, oh man, I just want to throw my stuff away.
No, don't do that. Don't do that. Don't throw it away. No, it's, you know, the glory of the internet is that you can make it look pretty and you can make it seem like it's flawless. But in reality, it takes a shit ton of time, effort, and whatnot to make it work properly. So while it may be cool, and when it works, it's fantastic, but it doesn't always work. And when it doesn't work, then it takes a lot of time. So just because it's looks pretty doesn't mean it's always pretty. So the cool thing with the less automated systems is they usually work 100% of the time. Not that mine is inconsistent or anything like that, but you know, just for me to do, since it's all automated, just for me to script a change, it can take days, weeks. So
it's kind of like this hobby is you get to choose your level of insanity.
That's right.
Yeah, absolutely.
But thank you for the compliment anyways. So who else we got? We got some other people who just joined. We got Dan, Fran. How you doing, Fran?
What's going on?
Oh, you know, just talking about you. No, I'm just kidding. What time is it over there? Like 1 a.m.?
It's actually 2 a.m., yeah.
Jesus Christ. You're dedicated.
Where are you located?
I'm currently in Croatia.
Oof.
Yeah. Oof, that sums up my life.
How? Yeah, pretty close to Italy. How's it head over there where you're at?
Where I'm at, it's actually, we only have like 3 cases, but because we kind of border with, we don't really border, but it's like maybe 50 miles, 100 miles away from the border. And like that area, we have like one person dying already. So it's, not fun.
I was supposed to move to Naples 2 years ago instead of Pearl Harbor, but it got switched at the last minute. I'm a little glad that I didn't. But I mean, it's just beautiful over there. And I know we had planned to go see Croatia and stuff like that.
Yeah. Well, this season is going to be busted, like tourist season. So
what's the new, my parents were just over there. What's the new hot spot in Croatia? What's the name of it that everybody's going to for tourism?
It's not really new, but Dubrovnik.
Yeah, that'd be it.
Yeah, that's it was like always kind of hot spot, but now it exploded because they were shooting Game of Thrones there.
Oh, okay.
So all those castles and everything. But actually, some of those castles are clubs, and I used to go nightclubs, you know, and I used to go there Saturdays, Fridays, stuff like that.
Nice. Yeah, my parents loved it. My parents just got back. Well, it was in the fall they went, and they went on some kind of, it was like a 2-week cruise, and they hit like 7 cities over there. And I can't remember where exactly they flew into. I think it was somewhere in Italy. And then they went along the whole coast and then went to Croatia, and then kind of back and hit some other places. And they said it was the most beautiful stuff they've ever seen.
Yeah, it definitely is. Wait, can you guys still hear me? Because I changed my thing on my phone.
Yep.
Let me see if my camera is working and all the good stuff.
Sure. Well, while you're playing with that, hey, Rob.
Hey. My first time on Zoom. I'm just still figuring it out. I've been having all sorts of computer issues this evening, but finally managed to join you.
Well, thanks for joining, man.
Because there is no tech support right now. India's in lockdown, too. So.
Well, you know, you want to hear a funny story. How many robocalls have you got now in the last couple weeks?
You know, I have a really good call filter. I'll have to look. I bet not many.
Yep. I noticed that a lot of, almost all of my robocalls and all the strange calls have basically gone to nil, which is very interesting. Hmm. But no, awesome. Thanks for joining. And
Figured I better check in on the first night here and
get
accustomed to this kind of social life.
Right. This might be the new norm for God knows who long, how long. Yeah.
So. Well, I've never been that social a guy anyway, but now I realize I'm a lot more than I thought.
There you go. Yeah. I was saying to the guys, you know, I'm kind of in rural Minnesota. You know, we have a solid 8 months of winter. I think you're in Ohio, aren't you?
Yeah.
I mean, you're not far off.
And we've had an extremely mild one this year, but that's I understand what you go through normally.
Yeah, and you know, so I'm kind of rural anyway, so I can go weeks without seeing people. So it doesn't really faze me until I'm told not to.
Exactly. That's it. When it's not voluntary.
Yeah, so now it's like panic, like, what do you mean I can't do it? I got to. So I see you there, Derek.
Yeah, what's up, man?
What's going on?
How's everybody doing?
Living the dream. How are you?
Well, you know, state of New York is it's not wacky where I'm at yet. I mean, you know, I'm near Syracuse, so it's I talked to my father the other day, and where I grew up is like near Poughkeepsie, so it's like 70 or 80 miles north of the city. So he said it's a little wackier there.
Sure.
But you know, we're approaching. They basically got the word today that Sunday, everything non-essential is shutting down Sunday. So.
Okay.
100% workforce lockdown for non-essential businesses, which is like basically I'm good because I work for a utility, so we're all, the whole engineering staff is telecommuting, and but everything else, sans grocery stores and trucking and stuff like that is shutting down, which sucks because we're, you know, hey George, we sold our house, so we were trying to close on the 3rd.
Yep.
So we got a call from the lawyer today, and basically, you know, attorneys are non-essential, so he doesn't know that we're going to be able to schedule a closing date. So.
Yeah, I was just going to ask about that. I was going to say, it looks like you're still at your old house. I was wondering when you were leaving.
Well, we're getting pretty close. We're pretty packed up, and before that, you know, we're still going. I think we're still going to go business as usual, hoping that there might be a window in there where we can get everything squared away. But other than that, I think it's pretty much the same as everybody else. We're not out and about type people anyway. You know, we're not all over the place. So this wasn't like a huge hit to our normal. Yeah, other than the, you know, I'm home, you know, they're basically saying now that we might be telecommuting until like May.
Yeah.
And the kids are home from school. So I'm not 100% sure. I don't know if they'll go back is what it seems like at this point. Cause they're through, you know, they're home through to spring break basically.
Yep.
So.
Yeah. So my wife's a teacher, and what they told her is basically they're not going back. Yeah, roughly that's what they're planning on. No one's going back. Yeah. What they did was what my wife's school did was basically gave parents 2 days last week. So the governor shut down all schools and all that kind of stuff a week ago Sunday, and gave teachers 2 weeks to plan,
right,
figure out the e-learning whole deal. And then they went to school this week, and then by Wednesday, like an emergency email went out to the parents and said, your kids have to get here, or you have to get here between Thursday and Friday of this week to pick up all your kids' stuff from their locker and from their desk. You're not going back, basically.
Right.
And so it's kind of a, my wife doesn't know, like, it's kind of chaos, but
yeah,
whatever. I set her up a YouTube channel. I got her a streaming setup, so she's gonna stream all her lesson plans to YouTube. And
that's smart.
I don't know what else to do. And so we're predominantly pretty middle class around here, and but we still have people without internet and computers, so
yeah,
it's gonna be tough.
Yeah, I know a lot of the schools around here were sending home a lot of the electronics type stuff home. I mean, we're set up pretty good. I mean, I've got my, I've been working remote all week, so I'm set up with like a kind of a bare bones. I got a bare bones thing going on the dining room table. I brought a monitor home, brought my laptop, my docking station. You know, we've got fairly decent, you know, remote network access. I can't. It's not seamless like if I was at the office, but sure. It's enough to get the job done. And, you know, the kids have their iPads and we've got a computer at home. So, you know, it is what it is. Well, yeah. I'm just curious to know how it's all going to unfold and if it's going to take, you know, it very likely could take till the summer to peak.
Yep.
And really, you know, you might get a wave. You might get a couple of waves here and there, you know, as people, you know, get sick, get better. Other people get sick, and we'll see how it rolls. But
yeah.
It'd be what's the old school? What's the Chinese, you know, proverb? It's like, may you live in interesting times, right? It's kind of interesting to see how people react in a situation. You know,
absolutely.
You get a pretty good cross section of human nature when things start getting wonky. You know, when the whole toilet paper fiasco was a lesson in that. But so far, it's been all right.
Yeah,
I don't mind being home, but
yeah, it's the same thing here, and we're pretty kind. I mean, what I really honestly miss. It sounds really sad, but baseball. That was like, so like, I would consider myself a baseball fan, but I'm not really a baseball fan. I just love to have it on in the background.
Mm-hmm.
And so like all winter, I'm a big hockey fan too, but anyways, the baseball is what I look forward to in the summer, because on Sundays, all my family, my extended family, we get together at my parents and we have baseball on, and they have like a pool area and entertainment area. And that's always every Sunday. So like every Sunday we go to the pool, and I built a big giant bar for them and all that stuff. So I just sit at the bar and drink beer and watch the kids and take a dip and watch baseball. And so that's what I'm going to miss the most is not to have that.
Yeah. I got a guy I work with where like his entire social life revolves around going out and drinking and watching sports. So he's like, how, what am I going to do?
He's questioning his whole life.
I watched all my shows. Yeah. I got no sports. He goes, they canceled March Madness and I can't go out and drink. I don't know what I'm going to do. I was like, I don't know, buddy. You got to reevaluate your social life.
Yeah, that's
pick up low oxygen brewing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There you go.
That might be a little over his head given the I'll be right back, guys. My dog is doing the dance of his people, so I got to go outside quick. All right,
cool. Well, that's cool. I'm glad people are joining and we can just bullshit and forget about the world.
I'm in a hurting of a place right now. I don't have any beer in the house. I have about 12 gallons at Final Gravity, but I mean, I'll be a couple weeks so I can start drinking that.
Sure. That's a problem. That's definitely an emergency.
Those are the biggest problems I have to worry out through this whole thing, and I'll count myself out.
Yeah, no doubt.
It's ridiculous hearing some of this super negative stuff of like 800 people in Italy have died in the last 24 hours. You just think about how many families are just ruined now because of that, and never going to know where their parents went. Like, well, right. They got carted off in a truck and burned somewhere. Yeah. And just like it's fun to make jokes and stuff like that, but then sometimes I'm like, man, people are hurting all over the place because of this thing. But that's true about anything, you know. Like I'm not trying to downplay it all because it is a huge thing that like people die every day.
Yeah,
but there's a lot of people dying right now.
Yeah, it's concentrated. You know, it's and the problem is like, what news source do you read? Who do you believe?
Oh yeah.
So you know. what is the actual picture? What is really going on? Obviously we're guarded from a lot of that stuff. Maybe we're not, I don't know. But I think the biggest problem is the uncertainty. Like I'm the type of person who I would be like, just give it to me straight. Like, what's gonna happen? What are we looking for? Then I can prepare, because I'm a preparer. And so it's like this state of flux of, well, we're going to try 2 weeks and then what? Okay. You know, so it's kind of like, it's tough. It's tough to try and, run a family, run your life. And you're not really given any details to figure out what to do. So that, I think that's the hardest part. That, and you know, I'm not a political guy in any way, shape, or form. But it did really scare me to know that the government can basically stop us in our tracks. You know, good, bad, or indifferent. It was just eye-opening that all of a sudden, one day we're living life as normal, the next day we're not allowed to go outside, basically. I mean, paraphrasing.
Right.
But, sure. But that's crazy. And so I think a lot of people, that freaks out a lot of people too. And
oh, sure.
So it's interesting.
A lot of the news, like I sure miss the days when you could watch a news program or read a news article and have to guess about the political affiliation of whoever was giving it. Now it's impossible. But I think a lot of the news, not of the news, but a lot of what's being reported is being somewhat tempered because they don't want everyone to go crazy and panic. Like if they say you're going to be at home for the next 2 months, even if that's what they know it's going to be, people are going to go nuts. So I think maybe they're trying to manage expectations while also trying to manage panic.
Straight talk. A little bit of straight talk.
Yeah.
Which has been pretty good.
Yeah.
Which I was kind of shocked by.
Yeah.
You know, it's one of those things where you think that in order to prevent people from going crazy, you got to like take a little bit off the top, and they really have kind of been pretty straightforward. At least, like, if you're paying attention to, like, the stuff that, like, the World Health Organization is saying and the CDC, kind of, like, they're not sugarcoating it, but they're also not, like, they're like, listen, you got to just be smart. Like, be healthy. Like, make sure you're sleeping. Make sure you're resting. You know, you're eating right. Like, if you're feeling bad, then and it's not this, you got to take care of yourself. And you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, you could get pretty sick.
Yeah.
And you know, that's pretty refreshing. It was pretty refreshing to hear. And they've been doing a pretty good job in New York. Kind of they've been going through stages with the shutdown, where first it was like, you know, why don't you execute your continuity plans for business just in case? Then it was like, okay, we're going to do 25% staff reduction. Then it was like 50% staff reduction. Then it was like, we're going to come out with a list of essential businesses, and we're going to tell those business, you know, if you're not on that list, you got to shut down. And the essential businesses need to even reduce their in-house staff by like 50%. So, this is over the course of like, it developed pretty quick, but over the course of like 10 days, it wasn't like one day and then the next day and then the next day. It was like, okay, here's what's happening now. A couple of days goes by. Okay, we're going to reevaluate. And I've been pretty surprised. Most people, especially where I live, they really shit on Cuomo pretty good. They don't, you know, I got a couple of like the linemen and the, you know, the relay guys I work with up north, and they'll be like, every time I see the one guy, he's like, you know, your governor, Cuomo. And I'm like, he's like, everybody talks to him, he's like, your governor, you know, your governor, Andrew Cuomo, is a real shithead. But I think everybody's been pretty happy with how he's handling it, especially considering they're trying, I think what they're really trying to do is trying to lock it down, you know, so that they don't get a huge spread coming out of the city and out of the Westchester County where it started.
Sure.
But you know, it's in a state where you've got like 6 or 7 international airports. It's pretty tough. You know, pretty much all along the, you know, you can pretty much go from the city all along like sort of the Erie Canal way, and there's an international airport like every 200 miles.
Right.
So it's tough. You know, between New York City and Westchester County, and then on through Albany and Syracuse and Rochester and Buffalo, there's travel hubs in every spot along the way. The only place I don't see there being a huge spread is going to be like in the northern part of the state, you know, because that part of the state is pretty humongous. There's a, you know, large geographic area, a low population in a big area. So
Minnesota kind of is the same way too. Out of the Twin Cities, it's wide open. And I don't think to date there's been maybe one or two up north. We call it up north. Everything's kind of been down in the cities, and it's not a surprise. I mean, once again, we have our international airport right there, and you can take a nonstop flight to pretty much wherever you want. And it's definitely, I find it really intriguing as far as it, you don't really have to think very hard of like, how could this spread, when you could hop on a plane, well, 2 weeks ago, you could hop on a plane and hit 5 different countries in a couple days if you really wanted to. And how many people do you come across in every one of those stops you sit next to on the plane, you sit next to in the waiting area? I mean, no matter what it was going to be, if it was flu or, you know, whatever, it's going to spread. And I mean, when you have constant contact with everybody all the time, that's how it works. I mean, it's no different when, if you have a kid and they come home and they're sick.
The crud. Yeah. They get that school crud.
Someone else in your family is going to get it.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's really no different, but it's crazy to see it on a massive scale, you know?
My wife and I are pretty shocked about it. We've been following Italy, and it just seems like it just seems odd how hard they're getting hit.
Yeah.
given the numbers, and they're at a point now where, like, I think they're, as far as they've slowed down a little bit as far as new cases, but the deaths seem to be going up pretty dramatically. And it's I obviously there's all kinds of factors that go into that, but it just seems like, even if you factor in the fact that Europeans tend to smoke more and all this other stuff, Italy in particular, it's like it still doesn't seem to make sense. So it's either all the other countries that had high numbers are jiving everybody else, particularly China and Iran, or something in particular about Italy is, it just seems really, really odd. It's sad, but it's also like very, it's interesting in a way, because it's like, why are they in particular getting hit so much harder as far as
right
deaths are concerned?
I know.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Sorry. I just to say what you're saying about the not having truth in reporting from China, Iran. I mean, Iran like a week or two ago had mass graves being dug visible from satellites, and like, it's fine. And just knowing in my line of work, what the difference between what China's reporting and what's the reality, they just lie off their ass all the time. And like, to just make them seem more stable than they are and more postured than they are. And it would totally not surprise me if the numbers in China were like 10 times worse than what they were.
Right.
Have you guys seen the mobile phone thing in China?
How they're tracking people?
No, well, aside from that, they probably have, they probably know everything in it. But the number of users, apparently, so in China, apparently you have a phone number and it's, you know, linked to everything. So you use it for Alipay, which is like they pay everything through Alipay. Mm-hmm. And it's like, a phone number is like, it's stupid important to them. And there's been a report that they're one of two main competitors, just lost like huge number of users, like upwards of a million. I don't even know like what's the actual number. And people are like, okay, where did these people go? Like they switched providers, like there's no other providers. So
right. You have a loss on one side and the gain on the other if they just didn't evaporate.
Right.
Yeah. So people say that, look, these people might just be, you know, straight up wiped out by this thing. But China is obviously not reporting.
Yeah, that's...
Could be fake news. Could be from China.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No. Well, that's the problem. You know, where do you get your information? And I don't know. That's the dilemma, you know. That's the dilemma. I saw a really interesting story. Like I said, I'm not political in the least sense, but I try and take in my different information and process it. Basically, at this point, just log it and say, "All right, well, someone said this, someone said that." But I saw a really interesting article written by someone who wasn't a doctor, who wasn't a news guy. He was just a random kind of data nerd, which I happen to like. And he basically put together all this data, and it's an article written strictly from a data point, not trying to prove or anything, just showing, you know, actual numbers, and when you take the weighted average and all this different stuff, and it was, I'm not going to say it was true or false, but it was really interesting to see, you know, the actual statistics on graphs and all sorts of stuff. I'll have to link it.
Yeah, I was going to say, can you put a link up on the site? That would be neat.
Let me find it, because it was. It could be biased, but when I was reading the article, and it was really long, I didn't see really any bias to or for or against. It was just data-driven numbers, so it was really interesting. Let me see if I can find it here. I'll link it on the chat. But
You know, something I find interesting about this idea of China suppressing information, whether for domestic stability or because they understand the way the world economy is depending on them looking stable, or here domestically, where I think the White House asked a couple days ago for some delays in unemployment filing numbers to try and steady the markets. The problem is with lying to try and calm people, it only works if people don't already assume that they can't trust anything they're hearing. And I think that ship sailed long ago. Whether it's the people who think this is an overreaction or whether it's those who think that it's all a cover-up, you know, it's just, there's no point in really releasing anything but facts at this point. There's no incentive that I can see.
And that should be the normal, right? Like, all those things I was saying earlier is like...
But it doesn't hurt so much to try to manipulate people in normal times at this point.
Right.
But like, give us the facts. Give us the news. Don't give us your opinion. Like, it's your opinion. It's not necessarily what my opinion is.
Well, I think it, you know.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead. Sorry.
Just LA County just announced they're not going to test anybody unless they're actually like showing severe symptoms. So I don't even know what the risk factor is going to be going forward, because I don't know who's going to be infected and who's not, how many people in my city are going to be sick. Like, if 20% of my city is sick, I'm not going outside. If one out of a million people is sick, I don't care.
Sure. Well, you're not going to know for sure until they test. And with the lack of tests, I think in most places, what it sounds like they're doing is if you have symptoms, they will test for every other possible illness first, and only waste a COVID test on you if those all come back negative. There's still not really any way of ascertaining how many people are really carrying this particular virus.
I don't know what the lead time is, but I just saw something a little while ago that FDA is approving a test that comes back in 45 minutes for COVID. I don't know what the accuracy is, and I don't know how long it takes to get those manufactured. But that's something that happened today.
Getting them manufactured and getting them out there in sufficient numbers.
Yeah. I saw the UK has a test now that they're going to roll out that is like the antibody test. So that would tell like the reverse way if you've had it, because you would have antibodies in your blood. Yeah. And that seems to be a faster test apparently, whereas it's almost like an instant test where supposedly, where you just take some blood and then it's almost like a self-test that you can do at home. It doesn't require lab work. And that will tell you if you have the antibodies. That would tell you if you've had it or have it.
And that's so, that's the one they run in the thing. Okay. Remember when they were trying to figure out, well, in the original story and the movie, where they're trying to figure out who could possibly be the thing, where they know that the thing will have a reaction if you try to they do the hot wire into the blood.
That's right.
that's a good non-pandemic related, but
right.
But yeah, I think it's funny that this is the first time I don't really watch the news anymore, and it hasn't affected my life at all, which speaks to the quality of the news. But then the only time I've been watching the news is probably in the last 2 or 3 weeks.
Yeah.
And the best, most accurate information I've gotten has been in the last 2 or 3 weeks. Like, the only news that's impacted my life has been since this is all unfolded, because people seem to be accurately reporting.
Sure.
What's going on?
Yeah. Now all of a sudden goes the no bullshit route, because they're directly affected, right?
So
yeah, all of a sudden.
Yeah, there's been none of that, pandemic 2020. There's been none of that. It's kind of been pretty straightforward.
Yeah.
Ouch.
Yeah, it's all different when it affects you directly, I'm going to go grab a beer. I'll be right back, guys.
Yeah.
All right. Anybody learn anything new brewing wise lately? Any new developments or?
Oh yeah.
I've been on Imperial Stouts for the past couple of years. Just like, I probably brew 75% Imperial Stouts, and the thing that I hadn't been able to figure out was how to get the real chewy body that a lot of the big name stouts have. And the last beer I did was like 20% flaked oats, 12% wheat. And the wheat and the flaked oats combination really was the final key. And then that combined with doing a rest for 20 minutes at 115 degrees Fahrenheit just really broke down a lot of the glucans and stuff and made it to where I could lauter real easily, didn't have a stuck sparge or anything like that. And then I just transferred the beer into a barrel today and it was chewy, it was thick, everything I'd been working on. So took a while. I was trying everything from doing double mashes, high final gravity, high starting gravity, different mineral profiles, different, you know, single infusion rest temperatures. But I think it's a lot of it has to do with the grist composition.
What was the percentage of wheat?
It was 3% torrefied, 9% malted white wheat, and 20% flaked oats, with about 10% crystal malt, 10% roasted malt, the rest of it base, to, I think I got it to about 32 Play-Doh, and then added enough brown sugar to get it up to 35.
Yeah, I bet the 10% crystal helped you out your body too, as well.
Yeah.
Which crystal did you use?
Granulation do you get on that?
I used DRC 120 at 5%, and then 5%, crisp 77, I think.
Nice.
DRC 120 is a real good one for the stouts. It gives a cool, like, kind of cherry toffee flavor.
Congrats on hitting your mark, man.
Took a while. Played by money and grain, but you know, now I kind of got it down.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, you got that recipe saved. You can just do it again. I brewed a Scottish 80 shilling ale last Saturday, and started off, I was aiming for 1055. I hit 1055. My final gravity is supposed to be 1017. It's at 1016 right now for the last 3 days. So I'm going to let that chill in there probably for another week or so and put in some kegs. I want to use, I'll do something I haven't done before. I'm going to pitch on to the yeast cake. So I used two packs of the White Labs Edinburgh Ale Yeast, and I did like a 1.75 liter starter on that. So I have that in my conical right now. My goal is to rack into two kegs, the 80 shilling, and then leave the yeast in there, and then do a Scotch strong ale of about like 1.11, if possible, and then just pitch that right onto the yeast cake and use the, because it's similar characteristics what I'm looking for, and it should have a good amount of healthy yeast.
Yeah, that's a big beer too.
Yeah, I've never gone that big, and I've never double used yeast or pitched on a cake before.
Yeah, if you how long has that beer been sitting on the current beer been sitting on the cake?
A week,
and it'll be another week before you pitch on it.
Yeah,
you'll have some good activity still. Just make sure.
Yeah, I would think so.
Just make sure you oxygenate the shit out of that, because it'll be really oxygen depleted. But you should have good healthy fermentation from that.
A lot of the guys I talk to with the high gravity beers, they'll oxygenate every 12 hours for the first couple days.
Are you guys familiar with how Rochefort does it? So what they'll do is, I think they've got a couple 400 hectoliter fermentation tanks, and as far as I know, this is still their current regimen, because it takes literally an act of God for them to change the way they brew the beer, right? So
literally.
Yeah. So what they'll do is their brew length is like 100 hectoliters. So they'll take and they'll flow 100 hectoliters into the 400 liter tank, and they'll brew, you know, three or four times a week. And so they'll brew on a Monday. They'll put 100 hectoliters in. That'll start fermenting. They'll take the next batch from Tuesday, put it right in the tank on top of that. Next batch on Wednesday, and they'll brew one beer. So like they might do the 6 1 week, they might do the 8 the next week, and then they might do the 10 the week after that. And then they basically, they'll flow 100 hectoliters on top until they fill the tanks up. So basically you've got, what's the German term for that?
Drauflassen. Yep.
Yes. So basically,
Brian, how many fills do the Germans normally go on Drauflassen before they're topped off?
I don't know that there's a standard.
Would but you got to they're rocking by that. You got to think they're rocking by that point. You've got 100 hectoliters rocking. The next day you're throwing fresh wort basically on top of that. I'm not even 100% sure. I think they might I'd have to look up and see what they're if they even re-yeast at the same rate that they do the initial 100 hectoliters. They might just do
your aerated that's added.
I'm assuming fairly standard commercial process because they're all pretty modern breweries. I know in particular Shime is like fairly state of the art, and then Westmall is not that far behind them. And then Rochefort is kind of like they still have a lot of old school stuff. They've still got the copper kettles, and Westmall still got copper kettles and stuff. But it's not till you get down to like, West Vlateren will have, they're even more new school because once they took over brewing again from St. Bernardus, once they basically had St. Bernardus stop contract brewing for them, they re-upped the whole, the whole brewery and brought it to fairly state of the art. But yeah, I know Josh was saying he's doing mostly imperial stouts. Now, I don't know, obviously, that method is kind of tough at small levels, but it might be something worth looking into. Even if you wanted to be kind of crafty and you're going to do 5 gallons, maybe you do a couple of small, you do a small batch, and then the next day, if you have the time, do another small batch, pitch that right on top of it and see. It would just be something to try out. The concept being that it's always better to feed a batch that's rocking and rolling, rather than having to do a huge pitch into 5 gallons of beer. You basically let the already fermenting batch start to do a little bit of the work for you. And then I always found that interesting. I kind of had to tease that out of a bunch of stuff that I was reading at the time, because none of the stuff that I was reading made any sense. I'm like, they're making 100 hectoliter batches, but their tanks are, 4 times that. That doesn't seem to make, they're not equipped to fill it at the same time. And then there was like little trickles of information that came through out of something else I was reading that was like, oh, well, that makes sense. That they're all, you got to think that like someone like de Klerk was a contemporary of Kolbeck. So sure. the whole European brewing industry, even though they brew different kinds of beers, these guys were all getting trained in the same kind of stuff. So it wouldn't be beyond the realm of possibility for the old school German guys to be learning the same exact shit as the old school Belgian guys.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, I've thought about that process to try and fill like 30 gallon or 60 gallon barrels, because I can ferment maybe 15 gallons, 20 gallons of stout at a time, and I could buy an extension for my fermenter because I got one of the Blickman ones. But it's 14 hour brew day a lot of times if you're doing crazy step mash and a 4 hour boil. So part of me is just like, yeah, I'll just let it sit in the 10 gallon barrel or whatever and brew in a month and a half.
Sure. Yeah, those big beers, they're a whole nother world.
And you guys are on a whole different level than I am. I'm like writing down the things that you guys are talking about. I gotta look this up.
No, that's good. That's the kind of the purpose of the chat, just to brainstorm, and we can throw bounce ideas off. It's awesome. That's how it should be.
Yeah. And I haven't been brewing a long time. I remember about 6 years, but man, I gotta look up that stuff. I know there's that one book that you said you made a comment to me one day that I need to take a look at, when it was referencing to How to Brew by John Palmer. You referenced the textbook from what's that place called?
BLB. There it is, right there. Kunze.
Yes.
It doesn't be far from my side.
Yeah. I gotta say this.
Yeah, it's always around.
Yeah. I'm on like almost a permanent hiatus at this point. I just haven't had the time, but I'm still always looking at that book at least once a week. I'm like, oh, there's like a thing. I'll think of something, because especially when, you know, I'm trying to revive the spreadsheets again, and there's always something where I'm like, oh, I remember it was like, well, what did he say? Chapter 5, section 2, you know, it says chapter 5, it's like 5.3.2, and he talks about X, Y, Z, and I'm like, oh, let me look that
up. It's kind of like a star date, isn't it?
Yeah.
It is, exactly.
It is. It was funny.
Many digits.
I did a bullshit beer chat last night on YouTube, and someone had a question about Weiss beer, and I was like, chapter 7, I see the three diagram in my head between esters. I know it's chapter 7. And then I don't know if this is the same Dan that was there last night, but Dan was like 729. And I was like, that's it.
Bam.
So I was like,
I won't talk to Brian for like a month, and then I'll hit him on Hangouts or something, and I'll be like, you remember? I'd be like, remember what's the section on biological acid when he talks about the zinc content? And Brian would be like, bam, and then it'll just appear. It'll be like, yeah. We'll have whole conversations that are basically just section references from the Coons book.
Yep.
Yeah. Speaking of that, I had some success with a new Sauergut technique today. About 6 months ago, I bought these metal pouches. They're 2 liters, and I brewed a batch of wort just for Sauergut, and I filled a bunch of these pouches and I froze them. Sure. And what I've been doing with them was I've been like making single batches of Sauergut with them like a day or two before I brew. Sure. But what I did this time was I made the batch, I actually made it in the pouch, so I added Zauer malts to the pouch, and I used a sous vide cooker to. I could have used my mash system, but this I figured the sous vide would be less energy because I could put it in a smaller thing.
Yep.
And you know, squeeze all the air out of it, and so it's anaerobic, and it worked fantastic. Actually, it's probably better Sauergut than I've ever made. Just seemed like way cleaner. I think probably before I was getting a little bit of maybe wild yeast fermentation in there.
Yep.
And so these work great. I'd recommend them. They don't break when you freeze liquids in them, which is good.
Is it like a foil pouch or what?
It's like a foil metal pouch. Right,
Mylar, like what you get O2 barrier for hops or something?
I think so, except those are a little bit translucent and this isn't at all. It's completely opaque. But I got them on eBay. I'll try to find the link to them. Hmm. Although I don't know if I totally recommend the seller because they shorted me like 10 pouches. They gave me a refund for they prorated it, but so I guess I would recommend them, but
I think the only thing I'll ever trust on eBay at this point is Ted Hausotter. So
there you go.
Sure enough. But these are nice because this, it's easy to, you can slip a half-inch silicone tube right over that and run off wort into it easily enough.
2 liters seems like a good amount too.
Yeah, I put
like a decent amount for, you know, because you figure if you're using like 500, 600, 700, you know, ml in the mash, and then maybe three, if you know, it seems like you have a good amount.
Exactly, and I try to get a liter and a half in there, and then I've got. Since I'm freezing it, I got a little headspace.
Yeah, it's pretty sweet.
So far, it's worked out well. And then with today's, I don't know why I didn't think about like actually making the Sauergut in the pouch before today, but it seemed to work out well. So,
and then are you still making it on a per batch basis to use immediately, or can you store it for any period of time in that pouch?
I haven't tried storing the Sauergut, but I suppose I could. For a while there, I was trying to, even still, I'm trying to rely a little bit on some oxygen scavenging capabilities of the Sauergut. So if I were to store it, then I'd have to probably freeze it, which would kill the culture so that it wouldn't do that. But I don't, to be honest, I don't have any idea how much oxygen scavenging I'm getting out of it. So I don't know what that's worth. But
I'm just curious because Sauergut is still somewhere in my future, but I'm interested in any of the things that make it simpler that might get me a little closer to being able to practically fit it into my routine, which actually by the time this is all over, I might have all the time in the world to work on.
Yeah, nothing like forced retirement, right?
That's right.
I definitely like making little Sauergut batches per batch. I tried the reactor thing, and for me, just with my setup, doesn't apply to anybody else, but it was hard for me to maintain.
Yep.
But I do like making a whole bunch of wort in one batch and then parceling that out and then using that for individual Sauergut batches.
So let's say you brew 20 liters or whatever it would be. Mm-hmm. And so do you fill 10 pouches of wort and then you can freeze the wort and then you thaw out the wort, add or acidify it, make your Sauergut out of that. That's what you're saying.
So I would fill the pouches. I would add Sauer malts to bring the pH down.
Yep.
And then freeze it, and then bring it out of the freezer a few days before, and then add a handful of Pilsner malt, and then sous vide it at 118.
Yep.
So essentially it's a substitute for canning.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, you couldn't call it what I'm doing canning, but
without the,
we're lowering the pH. The
damage of the heat that people talk about so much.
Exactly. Right. And lowering the pH means you don't have to worry about,
Not
a microbiologist, but, yeah. But as for my understanding is I don't need to worry about the microbes since I'm lowering the pH before I freeze.
Yep. No, that's a good idea. That's a really good idea.
So far, no exploded pouches. So that's good.
Yeah, I've gone, I don't use my reactor anymore either. I don't brew enough currently, especially in the winter, to maintain it. So in the summer, I certainly could, since I'm brewing every week. But it's kind of a pain to maintain that reactor. So right now I just have a 16-gallon Sankey keg that I have a dedicated, basically reactor, and I just acidify 16 gallons and just keep track of how much I poured off of it with a flow meter. And when it's, a couple gallons left, I'll make another one. The problem I was running into with the maintaining of it was I have to pull a vacuum. I was pulling a vacuum on it to recharge it, and it was in a corny keg, and I was really good at maintaining a seal on it, but somewhere on one fill it must have broke and broke the seal there, and the next time I went to use it was like dark brown and smelled like vinegar, and it was like, all right, well, we're done with that.
How much residual sulfites can those microbes tolerate? Like, I'm trying to figure out if I should try and oxygenate down to as close to zero as I can before trying to acidify if I add sulfites to the mash, or if I should just go without sulfites and just kind of accept some HSA and try and sour it after that.
I would still add your sulfites. I wouldn't worry about... you're only mashing, so you don't need a tremendously high amount of sulfites anyway. You know, if you went with 5 or 10 PPM, it's a short deal. So like how I do my sour goot is I don't boil it. I just do a step mash, and then my mash out basically does the pseudo pasteurization for that. And so I just run off right off the mash right into the keg, into a perch keg. And so you probably don't need a whole hell of a lot of sulfites in there, you know, just enough to cover you for mash and not have to worry about lautering or anything like that. You should do a, like I do a 10 Plato, 1040 wort. And so I do that no sparge. So it's easy peasy for me. And it should be pretty easy for you. And if you use minimal sulfites, I would say if anything, they'll help you, maintain that no oxygen environment for the souring, because you're going to want to purge the shit out of it anyways, because you don't want any oxygen. You want it anaerobic. So it's probably going to help you actually. Is what I would say.
Well, cool. I'm probably gonna try it out next time I do like a Pilsner or some, you know, low oxygen beer.
Sorry, I'm laughing at the chat.
Yeah, I don't think we use enough sulfites to kill microbes.
Yeah, I mean that is correct. The sulfites, the sulfite amounts we use, the molecular level, we don't use enough to stifle any of that anyways. And really the reason why we have potentially issues with the sulfites and lack of oxygenation is because of lack of the oxygenation, the yeast doesn't really like that, so.
Right, because you're eating up oxygen that the yeast need. It's not that you're killing the yeast. It's the environment in hospital.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, I haven't done a sour yet. I'm thinking about trying to do a kettle sour here first and then go the traditional route, because I know the traditional route takes a good bit of time.
I'm not a sour beer guy, so I couldn't answer any of those questions.
Maybe I misinterpreted what you guys were talking about. Got to write that one down too.
No, we're talking about sour goot, which is traditionally in German brewing, due to the Reinheitsgebot, they cannot add like lactic acid or any, well, technically whatever. So
anything like water, wheat, hops,
yeah,
and yeast.
So adding like lactic acid to control mash pH is a no-no. So what they do is they actually create a sour beer, and it's called sour goot. And so it's not really a beer per se, it's a sour wort. And if you've ever used acidulated malt, basically what they do in at Weyermann or Best or whoever's making your acidulated malt is they spray the sour goot, which is this soured wort on the kernels. And it's that soured wort that they spray on the kernels that is basically lactic acid. And that naturally made, and then that lowers your pH because it's sprayed on the grain. So that's one of the big signature flavors in German beer. There's a hidden flavor for a lot of people in German beer that they can't really put a finger on. And we've kind of found out that that's it. And so you can create your own soured wort. It's called sauergut, and that's what we were talking about.
Yeah, thanks for the explanation for the layman over here.
Yeah, no problem.
I want to give a testimonial on this, that I've been kind of a skeptic. I'm a long time, you know, lactic acid is the easy way to go.
Sure.
But I'm curious, and I have been alternating using acid malt and lactic acids in my pale beers. And I have really just about convinced myself, although it's probably confirmation bias, right, that I can taste a real difference that I associate with what I assume is the sour goot when I get a German beer, even just using the acid malt.
Yep.
And so that makes me interested in pursuing it the next step to actually making sour goot. But for now, I think in my next one, I'm going to use lactic acid again. And if I can really taste the difference, then it's at least sour malt from here on out for me.
Sure. And the reason why it's The reason why, so you're taking, you know, 750 milliliters, we'll say roughly, just ballparking it for a pale lager, 750 milliliters of that pale wort, and you're adding it to your mash in your beer. And then if you do a kettle knockout edition, you're adding another three, four, usually half of whatever your mash edition was. And so you're left with a liter, at least out of your 20 liter batch, let's say, or your 19 liter, 18 liter batch, whatever you're making, a liter of that is soured wort. So that is definitely gonna contribute a flavor. Just what's like,
surprising to me is how much flavor even a small addition of
yeah
of sour malts.
Yep.
Because I suppose it shouldn't be surprising. It's the same amount of liquid concentrated down when it's dried out.
Yep, exactly.
It probably loses some aromatics in the process.
Yeah, the sour goot, the fresh sour goot is wicked. It like mine, and I found that Russ can probably talk to this too, because Russ or Bilch has actually tried my sour goot here. Everybody's sour goot kind of tastes different. It's got a house flavor. It's got a nuanced flavor, just like all the big boys too. Whereas like Andex is more like, to me, is more yogurty and tangy. Whereas like Paul Anders per se is more grape. It's like a grapey. And so everybody kind of has their own house flavor for the sour goot, because it's based off your house flavor of your wort and your malt and all that kind of stuff, because that's what it's made out of. And so it's just really interesting. And it all came to me. It's funny. I don't know if you know the backstory on how the whole sour goot thing came to me and why I started down that path. Was Bill or Russ, we've got together a few times, and one of the times he was here, we went down to a local German restaurant that used to be really good for fresh beer and whatnot. And so we went down there after hanging out here, and we had some food and had a couple beers. Well, they had some really fresh Paulaner pills and on tap, and I was drinking it, and I could pick up this grape flavor, and I was talking to Russ and saying, I don't really know what that is, but I've been getting hints of it in my beer. And we were kind of talking through how that could be. Well, what I found out, so I was thinking back, and this was during the time when we went from kind of normal pils malt pHs to really high pils malt pHs, kind of like where they are today at like the DI pH of like the Barkey pils is like 5.85, 5.9. It was really high. And before it was low. And what I found back going through my brew log was that I was using quite a bit more percentages of acid malt. And so I thought, well, what the hell? There's some kind of correlation between this nuanced flavor I'm picking up in my beer and it increasing with the increasing acid malt. Well, what does the acid malt have? Well, it has sour goot. So that's kind of how we came up with the logical kind of thing. And then once we kind of nailed on that, or kind of had a hypothesis on that, then I came back and I made my first batch of sour goot and put it in a beer, and it was like, yeah, that's it. That's it. There's no ifs, ands, or buts. And I could take that same beer that I brewed with acid malt and brew it with the sour goot, and it was like if it was a 2 or a 3 with the acid malt, it's like a 10 with the sour goot. And so it has the same kind of signature flavors. Like mine is very, I would say, Cheerios like. It's very acidic. Mine comes in right around 2.0 pH, or I'm sorry, 2.0 acid percentage. So it's very acidic, but it's really kind of like Cheerios. Mine is really kind of like a fruity Cheerios. It's like Cheerios and lemon juice is kind of what mine tastes like. And they'll probably all have a little bit different flavor, because the flavor is going to be based off the grains you're using and the bugs you're getting from the grain. So, yeah, it's just really interesting. So
that's interesting because Cheerios is, you know, there's been a lot of people trying to characterize the flavor they get out of LOB.
Sure.
Pale beers, and hear different cereal descriptions, grape nuts or whatever. And I said, well, I think mine is Cheerios.
Yep.
And that's the flavor. And so that maybe that's just a characteristic flavor of low oxygen pale malt, which is maybe taken to an extreme in sour goot when you're really doing an anaerobic process throughout.
Yeah. I mean, there's the raw character of what your mash tastes like, because it's just mashed wort. You know, it's non-boiled for me. It's non-boiled. It's non-hop. So whatever your wort tastes like after mashing, that's exactly what your sour goot flavor is going to take on. It's not going to take on any fermented character, because there's no fermentation going on. And so
melanoidins generated in a boil or anything. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's just raw wort. And so that raw wort, that warty character transfers on through. And then you get the sourness or the twang from that lactic, from that high lactic. And so it's really interesting. I don't know. How about you, Andrew? What do you think your sour goot tastes like?
Yeah, when I hear your description, I agree. But I think what I probably would have said, like, before, sorry, there's a
no worries.
Family's watching a Harry Potter marathon in the next room.
nice.
I would have said like a grape nuts and orange juice.
Sure.
It's almost like, at first it's almost unpleasant because it's like you poured orange juice on your cereal. You ever do that?
No.
And actually taste it. You get up in the morning, you're so tired. Happened to me once as a kid. It never happened again after that because I learned.
I would think that would be more of a college experience.
I'm definitely going to agree with the orange juice notes. You get kind of like a unsweet orange juice, you know, maybe just a little bit of malt way in the background.
But exactly, unsweetened.
Kind of like a lactic, unsweet orange juice.
Right.
But Brian's sour goot was a bit different when I tasted that. I got less orange juice on it, but more maybe like, I don't know, it's hard to explain, but you could definitely tell the higher acid percentage. I do the batch-wise sour goot, and so I get maybe 1.7%. acid, titratable acid, so nowhere near the level that he's got. So it really kind of changes the flavors drastically, you know, on the finished batch if you're going to do like a reactor versus batch wise. But I've been making batch wise for probably 3 years now, so, and I think I've tasted about every kind of variant of sour goot you can get, because pretty much every time it's a little bit different. Like Brian says, depends on what's on the malt, you know, that week.
Yep. Yeah, there's a little bit of flora and fauna to it. And so the you know, like when I was maintaining my reactor, when I make my bulk one, with the reactor, whatever I pulled off, I refilled. So there was always some of, you know, there was always like 90% of the old and then 10% new, and 90% old, 10% new. So it kept kind of the same flavor profile. But if you're going to start, you know, if you make it batch to batch, every time it's going to just be a little different. It's going to be another, you know, different nuanced flavor, which is cool anyways. So
you can see how the German breweries all have different flavors. You know, like you said, they find something that they like, and then they keep inoculating that same batch over and over again. So it's kind of cool to go drinking over there once you get used to what the flavor of sour goot is. You know, it's kind of hard to pick out, you know, at first if you're not used to German beers, but once you know what it tastes like, then it's fun going on the tour over there and going, oh, I have this stuff, you know, what kind of flavor do they got? Because the rest of the beer is pretty much the same, you know, malt, hops, whatever, you know, maybe some yeast differences, but most of the difference in Germany is the sour goot. And that, that's like the fun of it for me.
Yeah, it's that never mentioned fourth pillar of German beer flavor.
Yeah, no doubt. And here we're missing all that. People think, you know, Americans know how to make beers, but I mean, that'd be like, you know, if there was a country where they didn't use hops and thought they knew what they were brewing.
Yep.
You know, to me, it's like an essential part of beer that is totally missing here. well, I mean, that and skill, that's kind of lacking here too, but.
But hey, Brian, do you have any idea of the history? Because sauerkraut is, I think, a fairly recent, I mean, in the scheme of things, adaptation in German brewing. Is it not? I mean, acid malt was once more commonly used. Now pretty much everybody is using their own sauerkraut. But it's not, you know, a century ago, they didn't know from acidification, right? So, or they were doing overnight sour mashes.
Well, they were doing acid rests, really long acid rests. Yeah.
But when did sauerkraut, you know, unique to each brewery, really become this essential character of the beer?
That's a fantastic question. I don't think I know the answer to it, but if I were to guess, you should
find out.
Yeah, if I were to guess, I would say 60s and 70s.
Yeah,
because that's kind of when the whole brewing revolution over there kind of happened, and when they started to really streamline, to really understand the role that like oxygen plays and you know, shear stress, thermal stress, mm-hmm. all those different deals. I think that's the 60s and 70s is really when they kind of hammered down on that. So that's what I would guess, but I'll research that.
That really is then in the grand scheme of German brewing, a pretty recent innovation. Thing.
Yeah. 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 It's definitely not like 15, 16. Yeah. So I would definitely say, yeah, it's probably a newer thing. I'll ask some of my guys over there too. Cause that's interesting. I never thought about it that way.
I mean, pH is a new idea in the history of German brewing itself, isn't it? I mean,
yeah. So. Yeah, I mean, definitely within the last, I would say that probably the early 1900s, they started realizing about.
Yeah, started understanding how to actually measure and control things, which had been done empirically before that. So you had those acid rests and, oh, the beer was a little better.
Yeah, but I mean, in the grand scheme of things, yeah, that's newer.
It just seems to me that sauerkraut is really the newest element.
Yeah, probably. I will research that. That's a great question.
I look forward to hearing.
Hey, I question it. So when making a sauerkraut, what's the like, if you're starting fresh, what's the lead time I got to plan for, you know, like if I make a yeast starter, I start, you know, ahead of time of making a sauerkraut. How much ahead of time you got to make that?
How much time do you usually give your yeast starters?
It depends on what I'm making, I guess. You know, I get a few days for an ale or a little bit longer. If I do a two-step for like a lager, then I'll, you know, more days to that.
Well, in the books, in the textbooks, it says like 48 hours. So supposedly in a reactor where they're constantly topping up, I think it's 24 to 48 hours for max acidity. But in real life for us, if you're making a small batch, it'll probably be 3 to 4 days. I'll defer to like Andrew and Russ, if you're making batch-to-batch sauerkraut, how long do you wait?
I go 5 days, usually.
Sure.
It's 3 days, you get about 90% of the acidity, and the last 2 days, you'll get, you know, the last 10%. So you got most of the flavor in 3 days, but, you know, as long as you got it hot and as long as it's sitting there, then generally what I do is drop it back down to about 105 degrees. From 120, but 120 for the first day or two, and then start backing it off, and it'll usually get a little bit higher acidity at a little bit lower temperature at a few days longer. But you know, if you're rushing it, 3 days.
Sure. And then the other curveball is, you know, what your acid percentage is going to be on that short. What I've found in kind of back of the napkin calculations is if you're going about 3 days, you'll probably be at about 1.25%. And if you figure around 1.25%, probably be pretty close. So like if you use Brewing Water or whatever beer calculator you use, and if it has a lactic acid dosing for acidification, all you simply have to do is instead of 88% lactic acid, just switch that to 1.25, and that should pretty accurately dose whatever you want to do. Cool. Where are you at, Dave?
Woodbury, so not too far from you.
Yeah. Oh, nice to see you here.
Same corner of the world.
Yeah. Awesome.
Actually, let me say that again. I said that the batch-wise was 1.7% acid. It's not. It's about 1.2% acidity is what I usually get. So I just had to look up my notes. It's been a while since I made it.
Sure.
So last batch was like 1.19%.
Yeah. So yeah, if you put in 1.2% roughly or whatever into whatever calculator you use for your, you know, if you use Brewing Water or whatever you use, that should get you pretty close. I mean, you can do the calculations too, but it's just easy to use Brewer's Friend or whatever you got to do that. So
cool.
Yeah, Sauerbrut's an interesting, it's an interesting beast.
I'm assuming you guys always brew with Sauerbrut when you're brewing your German style beer.
I acidify with Sauerbrut no matter what, because I have a setup where it's dosed and it's auto dosed into the mash tun, and there's a flow meter and all that stuff, and all my acidification, no matter what beer style I make, is dosed with that, just because that's what it's set up to do. So,
and is that just trying to hit your target mash pH, your add to what you need?
Yep.
So I usually, like my mash pH, just using the grain bills that I throw together, it usually hits like 5.3, 5.2 without having acidification. So I'm assuming the malt bills for more traditional German beers that you brew have less
acidic
or moderate, less acidity in the malt.
Acidic, yeah. So like the Pilsner malt is going to be your least acidic malt you have, so your pH will be the highest. So like, let's say you're going to brew a Pilsner and it's going to be 100% Pils malt, it's going to drive that pH up to, you know, 5.6, 5.7 probably, and that's of course depending on water chemistry and all that fun stuff too. But let's say you use distilled water and little to no water salts and a Pils malt, it's going to be high. It's going to be probably high 5.7s, somewhere around there. So that's where that comes in, because you'll probably dose on a Pilsner or something like that, you probably dose, depending on the acidification of that Sauerbrut, anywhere from 400 to 800 milliliters.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's just
and you just have that on hand. Is that something you have to keep at a constant temperature at all times? Is that something you have to keep refrigerated? How's that work?
So you acidify it at a warm temp, 120 right. degrees roughly, and then once you hit the acidity you want, you can basically do whatever you want with it. You can put it in the fridge. Mine just sits out room temperature.
So wait, I can store it at room. Sorry, I can store it at room temp. I thought I need to store it at 30, 38 or whatever the fermentation temperature was.
Only if you want to maintain the reactor. Because what's going to happen, if you don't maintain the reactor, it's going to get to its max acidity and it's going to stop. It's going to kill it, basically not kill itself. It's going to put itself to sleep, basically. And so there's no point in keeping it up there. The only reason why is when you maintain that reactor, you want those bugs, you know, ready to rock on that new, when you're running off that new wort into the reactor so they can chomp on that. But... Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. So that was like a deal breaker, yeah.
I think it's just like beer. The colder you store it, the longer it's going to last.
Yep.
And is there like a traditional like shelf life on that stuff?
Not that I know of. See, the professionals maintain a reactor, and how the reactor works is every time they brew, they pull off and acidify the wort. And then on the sparge, well, no, I lied. So they pull off, and then on the first runnings, they half that usually with water. They blend water, and then they fill the reactor. So there's this constant flow of in and out in the reactor. And these guys, these professional brewers, are basically brewing every day. And so every day they're constantly topping up, or close to. They're topping up, they're pulling out, and they're topping up. They're pulling out, and they're topping up. And so these reactors are maintained basically like a fermenter, where it's always at, you know, 38°C or something like that, 40°C. And so they just continually cycle through it. So there's really no life, or there's really no best by date, because it's fresh every day. So,
but Weyermann sells it in bulk, and so you could probably get guidance there on what a shelf life would be.
Yeah, Weyermann's is different though. They concentrate it.
Right. So, that's right. It's kind of like sour Cinnamar, isn't it? It's similar.
Yeah, like
process.
Like Sauergut is like a super light blonde beer or a pilsner. Yeah. That's not hop. But the Weyermann, that shit's like tar, is what it's like.
I've never seen it, because what, you have to buy multiple barrels in order to get it.
I think you can get a 2-kilogram bag in a box is the smallest one. That's the one I played with. Huh. But it's different. It's since it's, I think they evaporate it like the Cinnamar, like they're doing the Cinnamar. And so I don't think it's really boiled, but it's very concentrated. And it's super high gravity too. It was like 1.120 or some crazy gravity of sugar. And so I think they use that to help with shelf life, because, right. Yeah, it had a crazy shelf life too. It was like 6 months from the day it was opened or something like that at room temperature. And then at fridge temperatures, it was like a year. It was strange.
So my experience with Batchwise is about 6 months tops, storing it in the refrigerator. I make it in mason jars, and so you can really easily see when it's starting to go, because, again, like Brian said, it's light wort, and it picks up oxygen just like any beer. So, you know, even in well-sealed mason jars, it still will pick up a little bit, and you can see it start to go darker. You know, every month you open up the fridge and look at it, and you can see it on its way. So I'd say, you know, maximum freshness maybe 3 months, and then, you know, declining. You can still use it probably out to 5 or 6 months. Beyond that, yeah.
Now, Russ, is that isolated from the environment for the whole time? And are you filling that into jars and then closing them up, or is it made in the jar and then
I stored? I make it in a jar. So I make a batch of beer and, you know, unhopped wort, and I boil it for a little while, and then I do my acidification right in the kettle. And I take it down to, I got my notes here, 5-something. What did I take it to? 5.4. No, 5.1 is what I took it to. And then I inoculate it with, I use Heidelberg malt just because it's lightly kiln. I figure it's probably got more bugs on it, but Pilsner malt will work. Some people even use sour malt, but I don't use it. So, you know, pills or something light like that. And I inoculate it and close the jar, just seal it up tight, and then into a water bath. And I take it to roughly 120 for a day, and then down to like 115, and then for a couple more days. And then I finish it off at about 105, 110. You don't have to play those games, but it gets you a little bit higher.
Right, key to the yeah. Shelf life is having it completely closed off throughout. Yeah.
Most people are scared about it because they figure it's going to explode, but, you know, it doesn't create any CO2 or right. any gases. In fact, if anything,
it proves you've done it wrong. So,
right.
Yeah. And mason jars are nice with that silly ring on there. You can't overpressure them and explode them. They'll actually bend that
right.
that screw top on there and pop up. So if you're nervous about it, you know, basically just crank them down tight. And then that's it. They sour them. And then after they're done, they go straight into the fridge and they live until I use them. And it's pretty simple. And, you know, I mean, probably not as easy as doing batch wise, but for somebody that doesn't use it as often, you know, it works pretty good for me. I can make like, oh, I don't know, I make a batch of beer and I get like 20, 21 jars, I think, at a time. So, you know, it takes me out for a while.
Sure. Speaking of gas, does it have to be stored under nitrogen if you're putting it into like a keg? Can you use CO2? Obviously, it'll carbonate, but.
Yeah, it really won't. I guess just it depends on
what the pressure, yeah.
Yeah, or, you know, what temp. But, like I store mine under CO2 or nitrogen because it's right off my nitrogen tank that I use for the brewery. But CO2 works just as well. The biggest thing is they're hypersensitive to oxygen when you're starting to sour and stuff like that. Like you want to have that container when you inoculate that with the Pils malt or however you're going to inoculate it. And we keep saying, I mean, there's people that will inoculate with like actual lactose strains and stuff like that. And Russ might do that. I'm not sure.
No, I use grain.
Yeah. And I use grain as well because you can do a pure lactose strain, but I find that if you use the grain, there's just a little bit more oomph there with just some randomness. And it's, seems a little bit less sterile is not the right word, but it seems like a little bit livelier in flavor. Like
the cultures you purchase aren't correct. You know, like if you look at Yeast Bank, Weinestephan, they sell the lacto cultures. I don't think you can get them here, but they're not any of the kinds that you buy from health food stores or anything. So my attitude is I got a better chance of getting the right culture off the grain than I do from the health food store.
Yeah. Yeah. But you just got to be really like, I've seen a lot of people have issues right when they go to souring. Like there's any oxygen in that wort, when you're running it off from the mash and you go to sour, you're going to know right away because it's going to be off. It's either going to smell vinegar or it's going to be rotten or whatever. You're fine with storing it. I mean, if you're going to make it in a keg, you don't have to store it under pressure. You can just hit it with, you know, 20 PSI or whatever to seal the lid and make sure the lid's sealed. And then that'll absorb. If it's at room temperature, that'll bring you down to, you know, whatever. So.
Yeah. I'm going back to what, was it Josh was saying about with like, having residual sulfite. I mean, you know, that should,
yep.
If there is a little bit, that would take care of any sort of impurity in the CO2, I guess.
Yep. Yep. Absolutely. 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 I was going to say something.
It's my experience with this is leaving the sulfites out of the batch. When I used to make sour grit batch wise, when I used sulfites, I never really cared for the end result. And when I switched to nitrogen purge mash and started making sour grit, then I really started getting some decent ones. So, I mean, some people say that doesn't affect it, but I don't know. I think my limited experience on it says the less sulfites in a sour grit batch, the better. Oh, it's just my opinion.
Could be. I don't really have an answer because I've never made sour grit with sulfites either. So, but at a minimum, yes, the sulfite would protect you from oxygen and whatnot. But I don't know what that flavor would be. But I am happy with all the talk about sour grit. That's awesome.
A quick question. So how much grain do you need, let's say per one quart jar or some, or I don't know, 20 liter keg, how much actual grain do you put?
I use about a pound. Like if I'm going to make a bulk batch, let's say it's 5 gallons, I'll use a pound.
Right.
Couple, like 3-4 handfuls. It doesn't, I don't think it really matters. I mean, it does a little bit, but you don't have to be exact. I don't know what Russ is using per jar. I'm sure he's got his notes.
For what? Oh, I make it 11 plate of wort.
And then how much grain do you sour with per jar?
Oh, I can tell you exactly here. I got the thing up. Hold on a sec. Yeah, 10 grams. These 10 grams of Pilsner wort for what is a mason jar, like 900 milliliters, something like that, 950 milliliters.
Yeah, real close to 1,000, yeah.
I don't think it makes a heck of a lot of difference. You know, it'd probably work with 10 grams or 20 grams or 30 grams. I think the point is like how much, you know, grain you want to deal with in your jar after you're done.
Yep.
But yeah.
Yeah. The other thing I'll say,
figure, is, you know, 10 to 12 grams per.
Yep. The other thing I'll tell people, if you are making it in a keg, put your grain in a bag.
Oh yeah.
Because otherwise you're going to have a clogged dip tube or.
You tell me about it. I mean, just recently I dry hopped with like 11 grams, my New England pale ale. And I double checked. I was like the bag, I double checked it. And I was like, it's fine. And it opened up and everything went to crap.
Yeah, there's few things worse than a clogged dip tube poppet on a keg. That's
It clogged the gas tube. I was like, okay, well, I'm gonna invert it and I'm gonna take the beer out of the gas tube. Like, nope.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. I had something similar with a raspberry puree that I used on a Hefeweizen that I split three ways, and I got almost all of it out before I kegged it, but enough of it made it into the dip tube to clog up my posts on the way out. So I had 4 gallons of really good hef that I just couldn't get out. And I know it's probably blasphemy for me to say I put fruit in a Hefeweizen, but I did it. I don't care.
I bought these little mesh discs that you can put on the end of the dip tube, and they work really well because I was doing a lot of adjuncts and kegs like coconut and coffee and vanilla and stuff. And I've probably clogged the dip tube about 5 or 6 beers that I've made so far. And the little discs, the little stainless steel mesh discs have worked great. And a lot of times what I'll do is I'll have a keg with all the adjuncts or fruit or whatever in it and throw all the beer in there uncarbonated and then use a jumper to another keg, push the beer through the disc filter thing into the other keg and then carbonate in that keg.
Mm. That seems a pretty good idea. Can you put a link to that in the chat? I got one of those little. I'm not high tech like most of you guys. But I got like one of those bouncer filters that I use to pump my cooled beer through into my fermenter. And I got some finer mesh inserts to go into them. So I think I'll probably next time I do some kind of heavy adjunct into the fermenter, I use those for transfer, but we'll see how that works out. It's low tech, low cost stuff.
I found that even if you have a floating dip tube, this is kind of going backwards into the sour goot. Even if you have a floating dip tube, still put your grain in a bag.
That was going to be one of my next questions. Does it sink? Because I have floating dip tubes and everything.
Yeah, no. Some does, some doesn't. You're screwed either way. You go with a normal dip tube, you're clogging it. You go with the floating one, you got floating grain.
Okay. Yeah, even doing it batch-wise, you'll get like all the grains to perfectly settle except for like 2 that float on the top. I always wondered why you get at least 1 or 2. But for the most part, it almost all goes to the bottom on, you know, jars. You just pour it off. It's pretty easy. You leave the sediment on the bottom.
Yeah. Yeah, there'll be a little sediment on the bottom too, but it's whatever.
You got to drink that for breakfast.
Yeah, so who was I talking to? So I know a gentleman by the name of Christopher McGregor. Christopher McGregor was from Texas. He was a science teacher. He decided he got the bug, the beer bug, and he decided, you know, I don't want to be a science teacher in Texas anymore. I want to be a professor at Weihenstephan in Germany. So he moved there and became a professor at Weihenstephan. And every morning, that's what the brewmasters drink for breakfast, Sauergut. And I was speaking with...
Don't blame them. It's good stuff. That's the problem with batch wine, just keeping it around. The lower acidity makes it easier to drink. You know, it's like an enjoyable beverage. Reactors, that stuff's a little tougher to drink. But
yeah, they claim that's how they get their probiotics. So that's their nutrient drink for breakfast.
I have my yogurt smoothie every morning. Well, it's the same thing, right?
Yep. And so I was talking with another guy who went to school there and graduated and whatnot. And he said, yeah, by the time I came back to the States, I had to get I think it was like a dozen cavities filled from the holes that sauerkraut burned in my teeth. He's like, that stuff was so strong, you could take pain off with it. So yeah, it was, it's interesting. I don't drink mine, but I taste it every once in a while to make sure it's all right. But yeah, it's interesting.
Another interesting thing about it is, if anybody doesn't know what sauerkraut is supposed to taste like, the Bitburger Drive non-alcoholic beer, the flavor of that is pretty much sauerkraut. I mean, that's how they make that beer. I don't even know why they call it beer, because it really doesn't taste anything like regular beer, but it tastes like sauerkraut.
I've never had that.
Yeah, it's like, you know, straight up thinned out sauerkraut with, you know, fizz.
Awesome.
Which beer was that?
Bitburger non-alcoholic, or what they call it, Bitburger NA or Bitburger Drive. They got a couple different names, sure, depending on the country that it's in.
Yeah, I've never had that. You know what I do want to try, though? I want to try some of that Heineken Zero alcohol stuff. Has anyone tried that yet?
No.
All the green bottle skunk and none of the alcohol?
Yeah.
Gee, sounds like the best of both worlds.
Yeah, you don't get any benefit from drinking the skunk water. Yeah, I don't know why they continue to do that. They're smarter than that, but whatever. I guess it's their flavor now.
No, also their look.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You can't get Grolsch out of green, otherwise they crash.
Yeah. I mean, Heineken cans are decent. They're good. But yeah. I don't know why. Whatever.
Well, the Heineken marketing, mini kegs are pretty good too.
Marketing over beer.
Yep.
That's how you sell it.
Well, yeah, that's the whole deal.
A couple of years ago, Pilsner Urquell in the U.S. finally went over to brown bottles. So maybe it's...
And now cans.
Maybe that just shows that Urquell has a more discerning clientele than Heineken and...
Yeah.
Stella. Tank Nova over here.
Oh, lordy, lordy. Like when I was speaking earlier about my parents going on the that trip around the coast of Italy and everything, somehow they ended up somewhere that had Tank Novas, and they were taking pictures of it as they were drinking from it, asking me what the hell it was, because they'd never seen anything that looked like that before. But my dad's kind of a beer diva, and he only likes like one macro American lager called Mick Golden Light, which they only make basically in Minnesota. And he's such a little bitch about it, but he'll drink water if they don't have it. That's whatever. But my mom loves beer, and she was drinking the beer, and she's like, it's just so fresh. I don't understand. It tastes so fresh. I don't really know what it tastes like, but it tastes so good. And so they were going there, hopping all over with the Tank Novas, and that's just crazy.
Yeah, you can get golden light down here.
Where are you at? St. Louis? Yeah. Oh, my God. My dad and that beer.
It's a cult following in Minnesota, although everybody drinks it.
Yeah, I mean, and I'll drink it too. Like, I'm not discerning when it comes to that, especially when it's free and it's at their house and whatever. But he's such a diva about it. It's the craziest thing. He will literally drink water if they don't serve it at the place. And so
I think this is the first time I heard of it. Michelob Golden Light.
Yeah, Michelob Golden Draft Light. That's like
never heard
the Minnesota beer. That's I used to work for Anheuser-Busch in one of their warehouses up here, and they would only distribute it at that time to Minnesota. And we would get 7 rail cars a day from St. Louis that we'd have to unpack. That was just Mick Golden Light from Minnesota. Yeah. That whole operation, I worked for them when I was in college, and it was an awesome job in college because it was always cold because it was a refrigerated warehouse. So no matter if it was summer, winter, whatever, if it was summer and super hot out, you just went inside and you could drive forklift and whatever. But they had this repack area. We would get 20 rail cars a day from Anheuser-Busch, and the warehouse I worked for distributed to Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, Wisconsin, and Iowa. It was a huge warehouse. And we had to turn that whole warehouse in 4 days. So no product we had would stay there longer than 4 days. And so the amount of beer we would get every single day that would go out on Budweiser trucks was staggering. But the whole reason why I loved to work there while I was in college is because whenever the Anheuser-Busch engineer or whoever designed the warehouse, designed and engineered where the trains came in, they put too tight of a slope on the ramp to go into the rail car. And so every first pallet of every rail car every day would get speared by the forks. And those beers couldn't get distributed. So they went into a pile that the employees, it was called repack, but really it was just throw away. So every day we'd have to throw away those 20 pallets of beer, and we threw them away in our cars. And so we had so much beer, and being a college kid, it was magical.
You were super popular, weren't you?
Yeah. every day I would have a full trunk of beer. And the cool thing was a lot of the beers were beers that we couldn't get in Minnesota. Tons of malt liquors, like super high strength malt liquors and stuff. And so there was no really rhyme or reason to how they packed the cars, and it was all pallets. So they just shove in pallets until it was full. And so every day, I mean, there was probably 12 brands or so, but yeah, you had your free pickings, and we weren't even of age, and they would just let us walk out with it. It was a different time, I guess. But
speaking of Minnesota, I miss Grain Belt.
It's still here.
It's still a good here. Beer for the price of it. I liked it.
Yeah, I mean, Shell's is still making it. They bought the brand probably 10 years ago, and they're making it. It's still super sweet, kind of bubblegummy, and delicious.
Nice and light too.
Yep, super light. That beer is 70. No, it 40. It's 40% corn syrup.
Really?
Yep.
That's why it has no color.
Yep. It's 40% brewer's grade corn syrup. So yeah, it's a crazy beer.
I remember a beer I enjoyed in the maybe mid-80s from Minnesota was Cold Spring. Does that still exist?
Cold Spring?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I think they've gone more crafty now, maybe.
Yeah, now they're Third Street.
But back then, they actually, I think it was basically just a pretty mainstream lager, but they actually had the word Dortmunder on the label, which was kind of
Yeah.
It just was a little bit, maybe a step up from the average, but.
Yeah. I don't know that, and maybe Dave can speak to this too. I don't know that Cold Spring is, are they actually making their own labeled beer anymore? I think it all went to Third Street, and that's like their craft. So they do tons of energy drinks now, and they do their craft side, which is Third Street, is what they call that. But I don't.
I think they contract brew quite a bit of stuff up there too.
Yeah, they. I know they contract for 21st Amendment out of California. So, but I don't think they have any of their own labeled stuff anymore with Cold Spring.
But back then there were, if you went up to Wisconsin, Minnesota, there were a lot of regional breweries that were still putting out an old legacy brand that was maybe still vaguely German-ish and sort of the last holdout.
Yeah, I mean, you still have those big beers out of Wisconsin, you know, all your Pabst and your, just you name them, they're still all there. They don't all taste the same, but there's some decent ones you can have, can get out of there. What's one that a lot of people drink here is Hams. Tons of people drink Hams around here. One of those breweries over there is still, I think, Krausening to do carbonation. I can't remember.
It used to be one of the advertising points for old style, but who made that? It was their
Heilemann.
Heilemann Special Export.
Yep. Yeah, there still is the Heilemann. You can still get Special X here.
And they used to advertise fully Krausened.
Yep.
I think that brewery, Milwaukee Sprecher, too, probably does the Krausening, too.
Yep.
Berghoff, that was another one from up there, I remember.
I don't know that one. I'm trying to think of the other ones that... Oh, there's one that I'm trying to think of that you would probably remember, too, and it's right on the tip of my tongue.
Schlitz?
No. No, not Schlitz. You know, when Schlitz brought back their original formula maybe 5-6 years ago, mm-hmm. that was actually a solid beer.
That was?
Yeah. Gosh, I can't remember. It'll come to me when I least expect.
I keep meaning to getting around to trying a clone. I've got a hold of some brew sheets from Schlitz from 1975 that I will confess were shared with me by Denny.
Oh, okay.
Out of a result of a conversation when I was still kind of participating over on the AHA forum. But it would be interesting, you know, to try and recreate something. And
oh, yeah, for sure.
I'm just trying to narrow it down to simplify it because they were using a combination of grits and syrup, which I assume is because they had maxed out their mash tun doing high gravity brewing. They had their blend of hops, which is basically Cluster and Fuggles, and it looks like it'd be an interesting thing to try and to see how similar it is to that recipe they brought out a few years ago.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, that recipe they brought out a few years ago, it was good. It was great, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
But, you know, I have a soft spot in my heart for all the macro stuff, so.
The Beast?
Yeah, I don't know.
I saw the Beast being made once. I spent a week up in Milwaukee. I'm in the Navy, so they sent me to go to a trade school at the Miller Coors, or I guess it's what is it now? It's Molson Coors or Molson, yeah. Something like that.
Yep.
And they went to like an ultrasonic leak test school where you walk around with a $15,000 gun to find air leaks or fluid internal system leaks, and it was just cool. Because they do that school all over the place. They do it like either like a dental factory or some kind of like slaughterhouse. It's whatever company pays for the people. And then they sell off the excess seats to help pay for the price. So I was able to pick the one at Miller Coors Brewery that time. That was just great seeing beer brewed on that scale for the first time. And then having a couple of pints of High Life at the end of each class.
Yep.
Yes, yeah, it was a cool place.
Oh, champagne of beers. Yeah, that's we get all those good beers here. We get all the Wisconsin beer we basically get here, except New Glarus. New Glarus won't sell outside of Wisconsin, so we don't get any New Glarus stuff. But
it was interesting. They were telling me how many of the brews there are made there. So like Keystone Light and Miller Light are the same beer. If they have some Miller Light that doesn't meet their specs, they just put it in Keystone Light and sell it.
Yep. Yeah. 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 That's exactly correct. That's exactly what, but I don't think it's Miller Light. I think it's Coors Light. I think you're right.
Yeah,
Coors Light Rejects is Keystone.
They even have the same can.
And, yep.
And Keystone was originally the super cheap Coors brand, right?
Yep.
Yeah, so that makes sense.
Yep. Yeah, that's...
Isn't all the big breweries just essentially one beer syrup they brew and dilute it out with water to their different products?
Probably. I mean, at this point, it's so highly automated, I doubt anything's...
Like I mentioned a minute ago, with the high gravity brewing of the Schlitz, that's since the '60s. That's what most of them have been doing, is brewing a beer to about 14 Plato.
Yep.
Which the higher gravity fermentation will also give you some more esters and some more flavor to it, and then it also saves
tank space.
Yeah, and what they do is they just dilute it with deaerated water in line on the way to packaging. And so they can get different brands, which really isn't that different than party giling in England 100 years ago. But
sure. Yeah, no, that's 100%. The
same economy.
Have anyone here ever had the Bud out of the tank, the high-gravity Budweiser out of the tank?
No.
No.
Yeah.
It's amazing. It's like a Bock. And so it's like 1065 wort, it's like 6.5% alcohol, and out of the tank it's amazing. And then, you know, it goes and gets watered down once for Bud and maybe twice for Bud Light or whatever it is.
Yeah,
you can definitely pick up those esters, you know, in Coors Light and Bud Light. You can pick up those high fermentation esters in those beers, you know. You get some of the green apple, and I think it's Miller Lite has some acetaldehyde, and they have those esters from that high fermentation profile, which is strange because that's what makes their signature flavors. Like, that's why people drink Miller Lite, is because of that, you know, apple flavor, which is really a off flavor from, or not necessarily an off flavor, but a flavor from a high alcohol fermentation. So it's just all crazy, people, how that all works. Did anyone of you see, I forget what platform it was on. It was a Budweiser. It was called the King of Beers. And it was about the internal Budweiser competition.
Yeah, I think it's on Amazon Prime streaming.
Is it? I didn't see it there. I saw it on some other new streaming thing, or something like that. But you're right. I did see it on Amazon too, I think. That's a kind of a cool thing too. So they have an internal competition to see who brews the best Budweiser, and all the different
between plants.
Yep, between the plants, and the winner gets the cup, and apparently the cup is coveted. But they have people from China and, you know, where all their different plants are, and they compete. And every week, I think it's every week or every month for a year, they send in a sample, and that sample gets tasted by the tasters at Budweiser and gets scored, and then they have a competition based on that. It's really interesting.
Yeah, I enjoy
it a lot. That's pretty cool.
My sister is going to start working at the Fort Collins plant. She's in there. She's getting into their like management program out of school. So this summer she's supposed to move out there. We'll see how everything goes with this lockdown and stuff. But I was hoping to go visit her and kind of get a tour at some point.
Yeah, they picked up all American brewing and distribution of Kona too. When Kona sold out to AB, that's where Fort Collins is, who's producing all that stuff now too. So, yeah, the Fort Collins was in that competition. I remember seeing Fort Collins. Yeah, that was a cool show. So if you have Amazon or even Google it, it's free. That was a cool show. I think it's about an hour or something like that. And it was cool.
I always get reminders that I'm not using all the benefits of my Prime membership. So, because I just don't stream the video. So, well, there's one to do.
Yep. And we all know we have some time now. So,
that's true.
Sure. No kidding. I'm going to see if I can get a curbside pickup of grains from a homebrew shop.
I was thinking about doing that too. So, my local homebrew shop is Northern Brewer. Or Midwest Supplies, they're one and the same. But I hear they're like backed up. Like it's like they're seeing like Christmas level.
Oh, I'm sure. All these things that can be done at home.
Yeah, Tuesday, I was into my local one. They said they're just getting slammed with everybody stocking up.
Yeah.
Hey, Brian, I thought you said BSG was your local homebrew supply.
Well, that's my local malt supply. Yeah. No, yeah.
What isn't Northern Brewer owned by
Candy Bar 2 at the same time?
Oh, sorry. Yeah. I think they
picked them up. Yeah. They Budweiser owns Northern Brewer, I think. Or they did.
They sold them in July. Right? They're owned by another.
That's right.
Yeah.
Last July another private equity group bought them. Which makes me wonder even more what Anheuser-Busch was doing with them in that period of time. You know, why did they acquire them and then unload them? And were they just data mining the customers? They could have done that without actually taking ownership, right?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I love a good conspiracy theory, but I don't know that there was one. I don't know. So I know quite a few people at Northern Brewer, quite a few higher ups at Northern Brewer. I asked them, like, that was the first thing, you know, like call them up, like, what is going on? And they're like, it's just a investment group. And, you know, we put it out and, you know, they were the highest bidder. Mm-hmm. And so, I don't know. Maybe they were just feeding me that because they were fed that. I don't know. But yeah, you could definitely get pretty wild with like, what are they doing? Did they get it to see what the market is like? I don't know.
I think they actually did try to like get into home brewing and like make some money. They did invest quite a bit in the stores, but then they... You're like, yeah, there's no money in home brewing, so then they sold them.
Right.
And I think that's as probably about as easy as it is.
Yeah, and I think there was I don't think they're doing great, to be honest, Northern Brewer and Midwest Supplies. I mean, they shut down one store fairly recently in Roseville, in Minneapolis or whatever, which was, you know, a pretty hot location for them. So I don't know. You know, I think the market's really tough. You know,
my homebrew club meets in the St. Paul store, and the St. Paul manager said that essentially they opened up the Minneapolis store to compete against Midwest. And about the same time, the guy that owned Midwest like, hey, you want to buy my store? And then now they had the Midwest store and the South Minneapolis store, and they're like, well, shit, we got two stores, so. They closed the South Minneapolis one and moved all the employees from the South Minneapolis one to either Midwest or the St. Paul store, which was kind of cool. But I think that would happen after they sold from
Budweiser.
Yeah. You guys seeing home brewing in general kind of decline? Because at least in my club, I'm one of the few people that brews even once a month. There's maybe one or two other people that'll bring stuff consistently. And we've got maybe 20 or 30 fairly active members, but it seems like people just only are drinking commercial stuff now.
Well, it's so plentiful, right? I mean,
yeah,
there's so many breweries, so
it's way different than it was 12 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, if you can, go down to the local brewery and get whatever you want, and you don't have to make it at home, and depending on your skill level, maybe your local brewery brews better beer than you could, and it's delicious and it's convenient. So, and a lot of these home brewers turn professional to open these. So
turn commercial. Can we make a distinction between commercial and professional?
I was trying to be PC here, but you're very PC with that answer too. Yes, I wish.
Yeah. Well, the explosion of commercial, professional, whatever outlets certainly probably put a hit on a lot of home brewing, but if the current situation causes a lot of them to either go away or just not be accessible to people, that should
bring
home brewing back up. And if a lot of them don't survive this, then home brewing should be people's best access to the beer that they want.
Right.
Well, that happened back in the late 90s too. It was a washout, and I mean with 7,000 or 8,000 breweries, there's going to be something going to wash out here too.
Right. Yeah, it's not sustainable. I mean, even in my area where I'm decently rural, I have 5, I think, maybe even 6 mediocre breweries within 20 miles. So I don't know how they draw enough people to stay open in a booming economy. So something was
donuts happen. In your beer.
What? Yeah. Donuts, marshmallows, whatever the hell you got, throw it in there.
All right. Fruity Pebbles.
Yeah. Whatever.
How to make beer right here.
Fruity Pebble pastry, sour, double chocolate, IPA, whatever it is.
Can't you get a milkshake at McDonald's and put a couple shots of vodka in it and get the same?
Probably could. It'd probably be way better too.
You could make a good pastry beer. I've had some really well-made ones from, people that know what they're doing, but 95% of the time it's like there's tons and tons of flaws, yeast fermentation profiles totally off, recipes totally off, doesn't fully ferment, and they just cover it up.
And this
beer sucks, throw some donuts in it and sell it.
Yeah.
one of the huge things that I'm starting to see now is this push pop shit. Have you seen these push pop? I don't know,
the brewery in Orange County was one of the first people to start these super fruited Berliners with their Brucicle series, and everyone's doing them now.
So that's what it is. It's a fruited Berliner.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And a lot of times it's like 40% fruit puree going into like a 7% ABV Berliner. And so they end up like 2.5-3%. I think it was like 450 North or one of these breweries was mislabeling all their beers, saying it was 5% ABV higher than it actually was. People tested them and it was this total, shitstorm.
Sure. So they're adding this post-fermentation, so it's just sweetening, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
A lot of the cans explode in transit.
You're right, because from
Golden Road, like that's like all they sell from Golden Road is all these fruit different, I don't even know what they are.
Yeah, I mean.
Melons and strawberries or something, I don't know. But they, yeah, I actually drink one of like the Wolf Pup Session IPA from them is one of the only beers that I drink these days. But yeah, all their other stuff is just like melons and I don't know what the hell it is.
I mean, I get it. And that's part of the reason I could never be a professional brewer is because you got to brew to what your audience wants. And that not is not necessarily what you want. I see a lot of brewers that have to do that and that I couldn't do that, you know. I mean, not that you have to, you know, you have places like Bierstadt and that, I mean, they specialize in three beers and that's all they're doing, and like it or leave it, that's what it is. But I mean, that's dedication, because you would get probably 50% more traffic if you did do it the normal way, which that's not their model. I totally get that. But they're completely different in their model. So I see a lot of brewers around here that, you know, chase these trends, and these trends are disastrous. So whatever.
Yeah, it's tough because, you know, every new trend, there's a learning curve, and the beers usually suck the first year or two people are trying to figure them out.
Exactly.
Have you guys tried your hand at a Brute IPA? It's something I had heard of recently, and then I tried one, and it's okay. It's like an IPA that they ferment down to like 1.00 or even sometimes less, just with the enzymes that they add.
Yeah, I remember that like taking off, and then it was like non-existent. I haven't heard that term for what, like a year?
Yeah, it was like huge a couple of years ago. Yeah, when they came out.
I hadn't even heard of it.
Yeah, just the balance seems off.
Yeah, it's like hopped seltzer water.
Absolutely. Like I went into my homebrew shop to get some stuff, and they was brewing it in the back for a competition or something like that. And then I saw it like a week later in the package store on base, and I think it was like Sierra Nevada Brewed IPA or something like that. And I just wasn't impressed with it. It's like they're grasping at things instead of just putting out the good beer. That's good beer regardless of what time it is.
Right. Yeah. I don't know. I have some of those enzymes here because I'm not sure why I got some, but I have some of those enzymes here. It's I've never tried them, but they scare me. I don't know why I would try them. But
it's gonna be funny when all these craft breweries end up having to make hard seltzer instead of beer.
They already are, aren't they? I know.
Absolutely.
Like, they're going bonkers. I know, like, a lot of the breweries that I work with are like panic mode. Like, how the hell do we make seltzer? And there's someone regionally around here that makes a hard seltzer base that's like 7% that everybody's buying, and then they'll dilute it and fruit it, you know, when they get it on site. But yeah, that's just a disaster. I mean, not that this hard seltzer is bad or anything, but it just, obviously there was a market to be capitalized on, because Budweiser jumped in, and who the hell else? Corona jumped in, and everybody else that just makes straight seltzer. So you got, you know, your White Claws and all that shit. So yeah, it'd be interesting to have to chase trends like that to make a buck.
I hope the craft brewers go that direction and get the fuck out of the beer world. Stop messing it up.
Yeah, the problem is, and like the problem I see is I'm just waiting for my request, because well, now with our current situation, I probably won't get the request, but I could see that request coming from my parents and their entertaining area, because a lot of those people drink that kind of stuff, and all of a sudden it's craft. So, ooh, Brian brews beer. I bet he makes a seltzer. And so I was just anticipating that, but it's so crazy to, that's just one of the reasons I couldn't be a brewer, because you have to cave in and do that type of shit.
Low oxygen seltzer. I like it.
Yeah. Well, how? I mean, I get it, it really has to be filtered. So, I mean, let's say you spun it in a keg, which is fine. I guess you could try a floating dip. I don't know. I was trying to wrap my head around it, and then I was just like, yeah, I'll tell them no. So.
All right, hey, I got to run. I got to make dinner, but I enjoyed listening to all you guys talk about beer and stuff I don't understand, giving me a bunch of lookups, but it was a good time. And I hope we got to do this again.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for coming.
All right, man.
Yeah.
Nice chatting with you.
Nice chatting.
Yeah.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah, well, if this is something – oh, Dave, I was going to ask you, are you in St. Paul Homebrewers Club? Is that where you're
– Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I joined what are they called? You'd think I'd know the name of the club I joined. Northeast Brewers Alliance.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I'm no longer with them now, but I didn't renew my re-up. But we were meeting at Midwest, so.
Oh, yeah.
They were cool. They were a good group of guys. So, I donated one of my Braumeisters to them to help them out for a club system. And, I don't know. I wasn't getting anything really out of the meeting. So, but no, they were really cool. What was I going to say? No, I hope everything worked out for the people that joined, and I hope we got to talk about beer and meet each other, and that's cool. Yeah. It's cool that we're at a point where we can just go on the interwebs and connect and talk about beer. So it's cool.
I've really enjoyed it.
This is my first time using Zoom. It's kind of a And it's a good way to talk about beer.
Yeah, I was running through, you know, a whole different mess of options. Like how could I do this? You know, we use Zoom a lot for work. And I was like, you know, it could work because you have the ability to join with a PC, a Mac, a phone. And for people who don't want to talk or don't have microphones, you can chat. So you can see chats. You can see people if they want to video chat or just talk. And so I thought it could encompass kind of everything. And if for some reason, like you actually want to use this as like a learning experience, you know, I can share my screen or someone could share their screen and do a presentation or whatever. And so I thought, yeah, I'll give it a try and just go from there. So I'm glad it kind of worked out for everybody.
Yeah, I really like Zoom.
Yeah, it seems to work.
I
did a pay version. There's a free version, but it limits you to like 40 minutes. And you can only have a max of 10 people. So I did a paid version that paid version gives you, I think, up to 100 people. And then everything is in HD, like if you have an HD camera and all that stuff. So videos in HD and there's no limits and stuff like that. So I think it worked well. I'm also recording this whole session. So I think at the end, I'm left with some kind of file that I was probably just going to put somewhere if someone wanted to listen to it again or whatever. So that's cool. Seems to work well.
How much is the paid version? I'm thinking about trying to set it up for my homebrew club is doing virtual meetings like this.
Yeah. So it's $19.99 a month for the paid one. I think you can get it cheaper if you pay for a year. I think you only have to pay for like 9 months if you do the whole year, something like that. So it's not astronomical.
So that seems reasonable.
Yeah. I mean, it seemed to be the best way to be able to encompass kind of any different end user and have features. So, and this was just a hey, let's see if it works. If it doesn't, it doesn't. But it seems to work. So that's cool.
I wish the homebrew club out here would use online meetings that wouldn't have to taste their diacetyl Band-Aid beers.
Yeah, you know, I was actually contemplating, if this worked out, I was thinking about actually using this as a, like Josh said, as a homebrew club, like, meeting setup, because you could have a homebrew club from across the world. And, you know, if you set up the right time, I wasn't very nice to Fran today. I could have set it up for earlier so you didn't have to tune in at 3 a.m. But, you know, you could encompass, you could set it for a Saturday at, you know, 1 p.m. or Sunday, I'm sorry, at 1 p.m. or something. And then you could get anyone from around the world to call in, and you could actually do presentations or do whatever. So I think we can use it even for like the low oxygen brewing forum or something. If you hold a monthly beer chat like this or something, that would be, I think that would be worth it too. So
yeah, I'd be definitely on board for that.
Yeah, I'd be on board now that I'm sorting through my technical issues and figuring out how this Zoom works. I'd be on board for anything you want to do with it, because yeah, I've never joined a club because I never thought that I would get anything out of it, that I wouldn't have the same interests as 99% of the people. But if you have a group like this that,
yeah,
that we are all sort of on the same page.
Yeah,
definitely.
Yeah. And you know, you don't have to drive anywhere. You can imbibe maybe a little more if you wanted to. You don't have to worry about driving and driving to and from. And so, I don't know. We'll see. Times, different times call for different measures. So we are definitely in those times. So yeah. I had the meeting scheduled till 10 p.m. It can go on as long as you want. We can call it, we can continue to talk, whatever everybody wants to do, I am fine with.
I'll probably get some dinner going for me. So nice chatting with all of you.
Yeah, I think I'm going to check out here too at this point, but you'll let us know what the time is next week if you decide to change it.
Yeah, I mean, if we want to go, if I'll post it on the forum, and if we want to continue with the same time, different day, Sunday. I mean, like I've been telling my wife, every day is a Monday. It's not a Saturday. Every day is a Monday. It seems like there's shit going on. So if we want to do a Sunday evening or whatever, I'll put out a poll or just ask people or whatever. So yeah. I'm fairly flexible. It doesn't matter to me. So whatever, you know, works the best for everybody, it works for me. So we'll figure it out. And then I can put out an invite again like I did, and we can join up.
All right. Well, I'll be back as long as I know when it is. So
sounds good. Thank you, sir.
Good night for now.
All right. See you guys.
Yeah, see you later.
See you later.
Nice chat with you guys. See you later.
See you later, guys.